This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Gordon Swenson. Today is January 22nd, 2010. I'm in Lubbock, Texas in the Special Collections Library on the campus of Texas Tech, and Mr. Swenson is joining me by phone from California. All right, why don't we begin, if you could tell me a little biographical information about yourself. First of all, when and where were you born?
I was born in Riverside, California.
Okay. All right. And when?
1949, July 28th, 1949.
Okay. Yes, sir. All right. Could you tell me a little bit of information about your parents? What were their names and what did they do for a living?
My father was Clarence Swenson, and he was born in North Branch, Minnesota, which is a very small farming community in East Central Minnesota. It's about 50 miles north of Minneapolis.
Okay.
And my mother was born in the same town,
mm-hmm.
and her name was Elsie Swenson, and both coming from farming-type communities during the era of the Depression and growing up in relatively poor conditions. When they got married, they moved from North Branch out to California to try to get a better life at that time. This would have been in the late 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And my father only got through ninth grade. My mother, I think, only got through about the same grade, so their education levels were both relatively low.
Mm-hmm.
But for that time and era, that they were right in there with everybody else.
Right, yes, sir.
My father worked a number of different jobs during World War II. He was exempt because he was number one, was too old at that point. And he also was working for Food Machinery Corporation at that time, which was a developer of military tanks.
Okay.
He was involved in that, so obviously he was exempt for that reason, too.
Mm-hmm.
My mother basically was a stay-at-home mom. My father had a stroke when he was fairly young, in his mid-50s,
mm-hmm.
and that completely disabled him. So my mother had to work a job, and my aunt used to come over to our house and help take care of my dad,
mm-hmm.
all during the time when I was 11, 12 years old. My father finally died when I was 12,
mm-hmm.
13, and then my mother continued to work as a cafeteria manager for the local junior high school.
Okay.
She lived until she was in her mid-80s, so she saw through the era that I wound up going to Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and went through all of that. So,
mm-hmm.
But anyway, it was a pretty typical childhood.
Yes, sir. All right. Well, did you have any jobs as a kid growing up?
Yeah, I started out typical kid for the 50s and 60s. I was a newspaper boy, delivered newspapers, riding a bicycle.
Mm-hmm.
I had one of the longest paper routes at that time and used to ride, must have been about 14 miles every day.
Oh, wow.
Delivering papers daily.
Uh-huh.
And when I finally got to the point that I outgrew that, I wound up getting myself a small little motorcycle and delivered newspapers from that for a while.
Right.
And then finally, when I got to a point that I graduated high school, I thought, well, I'm going to get myself a good job now. So I worked at a gas station pumping gas for 23 cents a gallon.
Mm-hmm.
Did that until I got drafted.
Okay. All right. Let's see. Where did you go to high school?
My high school was actually two high schools. I went to Riverside Poly High School, and that was in the old Poly High School days, which was the same high school that my older brother and sister both went to, and
mm-hmm.
it was pretty dilapidated at that point, but it was Riverside's first high school, and Riverside's a community now of well over a half a million people, but it was the original high school for the town. And when they decided to tear it down and convert part of it over to the community college. They built two new high schools at that point.
Mm-hmm.
They built one which was continued with the name of Pauley High School, and then they built North High School. And I wound up going to North High School, which was about a mile and a half from where I lived, and went there for 2 years, and we were the second graduating class. And obviously when they build a new high school, it's kind of wild because nobody really knows what they're doing. So
right.
It was an interesting time to go to high school there. But anyway, I grew up, like I say, in Riverside,
mm-hmm.
and went to school with primarily the same group of kids through the whole process from kindergarten. In fact, one of my best friends went to kindergarten with me, and we were best friends when we graduated high school. So
mm-hmm.
We pretty much had the same group of people.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. Okay. Well, while you were in high school, did you play any sports or any extracurricular activity type things? Or?
Well, I wasn't a real big sports athletic
mm-hmm.
player. I guess you could call me the 98-pound weakling. At the time, I probably weighed about 115
uh-huh.
And stood 6 foot. So I was a pretty skinny kid.
Yes, sir.
But didn't do a lot of that. I would say my two primary things that I did during high school was my circle of friends were always big dance fans. So
uh-huh.
we used to attend all of the high school dances and the junior high school dances. And actually, I'm one of those fortunate few that actually was on American Bandstand a bit. So
oh wow, okay.
Got to do that, and we had our series of dances that we went to. So we did that, and then I was a big hot rod car aficionado. I was always a mechanically inclined kind of person and enjoyed working on cars. So
mm-hmm.
We had our circle of friends that did that. And back in the days when you could street race and get away with it, so we did that quite a bit. But
mm-hmm.
Yeah, between those two things, it kept me busy. But like I say, I wasn't really the athletic type.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, while you were growing up and going to high school, did you pay close attention to what was going on in the world with the Cold War?
Well, it's an interesting situation. When at least in my era, when with the circle of friends I was with, we were pretty much focused on what we were doing and not necessarily what the rest of the world was doing. Back in those days, you weren't inundated with media.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't spend a lot of time watching TV. We didn't spend a lot of time. We listened to the radio, but it was always the top 40 radio AM stations that we listened to, so they were playing music most of the time. But
mm-hmm.
I remember seeing bits and pieces.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, obviously, I knew of the Vietnam War, knew what was going on. During that time frame, which would have been the late 60s, there were a number of protests going on, and heard about those, and had, again, my circle of friends were people that I'd always grown up with, so I knew all of these people, and I knew a lot of the people that were doing the protesting,
mm-hmm.
but didn't discuss a lot of politics with them,
right.
didn't get into that side of it much at all, and looking back at it now, I would have to say I probably was very differential to either direction. I didn't
mm-hmm.
I wasn't I wasn't a gung-ho big supporter of, you know, go USA, go get involved in the war, you know, do all of that.
Right.
And I also at the same time I wasn't one of the people who would hold a sign up and say, you know, I'm against the war or anything like that. I was just kind of a typical kid growing up.
Mm-hmm.
I was more involved in my own life than I was anything else that was going on in the world.
Sure. Yes, sir. All right. Well, backing up a little bit before that, how about the Kennedy assassination? What are your memories of that?
That was an interesting time.
Mm-hmm.
I was at that point delivering newspapers.
Okay.
And very vividly remember the scenario as it went down, I remember being in school and hearing about it at the time it happened. They played it over the loudspeaker system. I was in junior high at that point. I can't remember exactly. I was probably in ninth grade. But at any rate, I do remember it was over Thanksgiving because there was, quote-unquote, a dance that weekend, and they canceled it that Friday night, in fact. I obviously delivered the newspapers. In fact, I still have the newspaper from that day. And I remember very vividly there being nothing but the coverage of the Kennedy assassination for basically almost a week. That's all you heard about. That, that was everything. That was, which really made an impact on how traumatic that whole situation was. And I, you know, that's obviously one of those things that sticks out in my era of growing up. I don't remember specifically having any discussions with people, or any of my peers, about the whole scenario and what went down. I just remember it being a very sad time during that time, and you know, something that dominated your life for a good period of time.
Yes, sir. All right. Okay. What? When did you graduate from high school? What year was that?
1967. Graduated with, again, the same group of friends that I'd gone through all of school with. My graduating class, try to remember, I think was about 250 people. There was some influx because the area was growing at that time, so there was some influx of new people, but there was still that core group of individuals that I grew up with. Don't want to get out of sequence of your questions, but I'll bring up a comment.
Okay, sure.
I grew up in Southern California, and this was during the era of a lot of racial tension. My circle of friends that I grew up with included all nationalities, all groups of people. I had black friends, I had Mexican friends. In fact, I'd mentioned earlier about one of my best friends from kindergarten all the way through high school. In fact, he's still a friend now. Was Mexican American, and I remember very vividly his family, and I spent probably more time growing up at his house than I did at my house. I spent a lot of time over there. He had a younger brother and an older brother. In fact, I became very good friends with his older brother also, who was just a year older than I was. But it was my circle, my primary circle of friends at that time. Being a newspaper delivery kid, I worked with all of the kids in the neighborhood, and that included all the racial groups at that point, and considered them my friends. When I went to my 10-year high school reunion, one of the things that I look back at that night, and I think one of my proudest moments was there was a group of blacks that were, I'm going to say, the rebellious group during high school. They very much segregated themselves from the rest of the class. They had there was a kind of a mall area in the middle of our high school. It was a big grassy knoll that they took over. And they called it Blood Hill. And they used to, every time it was between classes, all the blacks would stand on top of this hill, and white people were not allowed to go there. You know, that was their area, their territory, and stayed out of there. Well, I knew all these guys. I went to all the school with them. And they knew me. And I never had any trouble. I mean, I never had any problems. Used to talk to them on a regular basis. And just never had any issues. I know there were a lot of fights going on in the school. There was a lot of racial tension at that point. But it never impacted in me in any way, shape, or form. And when we were at our, when I was at my 10th high school reunion, two or three of that group came up and said hello. And that just, I look back at it now and I think, you know, that was really neat. That was impressive.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's, you know, it's different than a lot of other people that I've talked to that grew up in that same era.
Right.
That had a lot of problems.
Yes, sir.
And I guess it was just the way I was raised. My parents were not that way, and I wasn't that way, and I considered them friends, and I think they knew that.
Mm-hmm.
They considered me a friend. So I guess I was really, really fortunate growing up in school because I never had any issues with anything like that. You know,
mm-hmm.
I know a lot of other people did. So, and my circle of friends didn't. So, that was just kind of a real good shining moment from that era that I look back fondly on.
Right. Yes, sir. Okay. All right. Well, how about did anyone you know from your high school and from your neighborhoods that you knew, had anyone, by the time you were, say, a senior in high school, had anyone been drafted and sent to Vietnam by that point, some of the older kids?
I had a friend.
Okay.
That was, again, in my circle of friends, guys, one of the guys I'd grown up with, that when he graduated from high school, he joined the Navy.
Okay.
And I can remember hearing different things. I remember hearing him going to Vietnam, and my impression at that point was that, okay, he's on a big ship sitting out off the coast someplace, and they're, you know, probably shooting guns at him, and,
mm-hmm.
but he's probably not directly involved in the things that I see on TV every night.
Right.
So that was just kind of my opinion, and then one day I heard that he'd gotten hurt, and I, you know, the kind of the running joke at that time was, yeah, he was probably out playing beach ball on the deck or something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, come to find out later, he was actually one of the guys that was out on the small boats that were cruising the rivers.
Right.
And he was wounded. Fortunately, it wasn't real serious. But he eventually got out of the Navy. He was in for 4 years. But he did wind up getting a Purple Heart.
Mm-hmm.
So, it was remote. It was something that didn't focus on.
Right.
I knew it was there. I knew the scenario, but it didn't impact my life dramatically. He was really the only person that I was closely associated with that I'd heard anything about. Now, when I was working at the gas station, there was one other kid that I'd gone through high school with that I knew, and he lived down the street, but
mm-hmm.
I wasn't real close to him. But when I was working at the gas station, he came in one day, and we were talking, and I wound up doing something, changing a tire for him or something. And he had mentioned something about that he'd gotten drafted.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, oh, well, when are you leaving? And he says, well, in a month. And so we didn't talk about it a lot, but, you know, it was just one of those things. Well, about 3 months, that must have been longer than that, must have been about 6 months later, I'd read in the newspaper that he had gotten killed.
Mm-hmm.
He wound up going in the Marines, wound up going to Vietnam, and was only there for about 2 weeks,
mm-hmm.
and wound up getting killed. And mm-hmm. that was one of the people that, he wasn't a real close friend, but he was somebody that I knew.
Right.
And there was one other person that I remember I'd heard that he'd gone over to Vietnam, didn't know him real well, but I can remember when I drove by his house, they had a big banner up in front that said, welcome home, and I remember he did come home.
Mm-hmm.
But those were the only people that I specifically remember.
Right.
Because keep in mind that it was my immediate core group. We'll get into this in a little bit, but my immediate core group, and I pretty much all went in the Army the same day.
Oh, wow. Right. All right. Well, how long were you, after you graduated, you said you went to work at the gas station at that point?
Correct.
Okay. All right. And how long did you work there before you were drafted?
When I got out of high school, I tried to make a decision of what I wanted to do.
Okay.
And decided that, you know, I really liked mechanical work, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, I'll go to college.
Okay.
Get my auto mechanics degree, an AAA degree, and, you know, get a job off that. So I started going to the local community college and was doing that while I was working at the gas station part-time.
Mm-hmm.
So,
all right.
Didn't enjoy college any way, shape, or form. Enjoyed working in the auto mechanics portion of it.
Mm-hmm.
Spent most of my time doing that. But at the same time, in order to get the degree, you had to take English, you had to take math, you had to take, which are the things I didn't particularly care for.
Right, sure.
So I spent most of my time working in the auto shop. In fact, I actually wound up building a car in auto shop during that time span.
Mm-hmm.
Between there and the gas station. A friend that actually was a teacher that used to come in a gas station regularly, and he told me about this guy that had this old 57 Ford, and he'd sell it real cheap. So I went over and looked at it. Didn't run. So I went over and looked at it and wound up buying it for $50 from this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And drug towed it back to the gas station and proceeded to try to get it to run, and the first time I got it to turn over and start, you couldn't see the car for the smoke coming out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided, well, maybe I need to rebuild the motor. So I pulled the engine out of it and rebuilt that during my college courses.
Mm-hmm.
Wound up putting it back in the car and had some real adventures with that car when I got done. It ran good. In fact, I used that to get back and forth between Riverside and Fort Ord. When I got drafted, I actually kept the car up at Fort Ord and drove it on occasion when they let me out. But had that until I went to Vietnam, and then I sold it to a friend of mine who had it for a few years after that too. But anyway, that was my adventures of that, and college was a secondary thing to me.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't that particularly that interested in it. I got a deferment the first year. I got deferments for that so that I didn't have to worry about the draft. The second year, for about the first half a year, I was okay. And then by then, I was just kind of getting burned out on the whole thing. And so I let it slide, and that's about the time they caught up with me. So
mm-hmm.
I got drafted from that. But anyway.
All right. Well, I guess if you could talk a little bit about the process of being drafted and your reaction to being drafted.
I can remember, this was during the heyday of it, was actually in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
So I was not going to college at that point. I worked nights at the gas station, so my nights were after I got off work because the station closed at 10.
Mm-hmm.
My nights then were out cruising and doing all the fun things you do when you're that age.
Right.
And I'd get home late at night. Or actually early the next morning, go to bed, and then I'd sleep till noon. And I can remember my mom coming in with the the envelope and opening the envelope and saying greetings. And I had, at that point, already gone down and gotten my physical. And during this whole process, my mindset, I guess, was, okay, I'm too smart for this. You know, I know mechanics, I know that kind of stuff real well.
Mm-hmm.
So, besides, I'm just a really skinny kid. I shouldn't have to worry about getting drafted.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I went for my physical, passed that. They put me in the appropriate class for passing the physical, and it wasn't 3 months later I got the notice, guess what? So, I kept thinking, well, all right, I'm smart. I'm going to get drafted. They'll get me down there and see how smart I am, and I won't have to worry about going into the infantry. They'll make me some kind of mechanic or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I got down there and got all finished with it, they said, okay, well, you're going to go in the Army. So, okay. So I got home from that whole process and told my mom what was going on. She wasn't real happy about it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the way it was going to be.
Right.
And I didn't have some people during that era were very much against it. Burning draft cards and all that stuff was real prevalent at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to do that. It didn't make that big of a difference to me either way. I just kept thinking, I'm not going to have to go to Vietnam. I'm not going to have to worry about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm smarter than that. You know, they'll get me down there, and I'll figure that all out, and I'll wind up being a truck driver or something.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of my mindset. When one of my really close friends at that time drove me to the local Red Cross office, which is where the bus picked you up from, and I went down there that morning, and I remember I shaved my mustache off that night because I didn't want to have to deal with them yelling at me about having a mustache.
Right.
And got on the bus and realized when I got on the bus that probably a third of my graduating class from high school was getting on the same bus.
Wow.
So it was a very interesting trip going up there. Now, these weren't all my close circle of friends. My close circle of friends, none of them wound up going in the military. I had one friend that joined the Air Force Reserves and spent 4 years doing that, and never wound up going into any combat whatsoever. But my close circle of friends all got exempt for one reason or another. In fact, one of my close friends, and I can only assume the story is true, was exempted because he couldn't lift his arms up over his head,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was kind of interesting because he was probably the most muscular and athletic of the whole group. And maybe that was the whole reason. But anyway, that's what the story was. He couldn't get drafted because he couldn't lift his arms over his head.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, the bus trip up, we wound up going to Fort Ord, which is up central California, and going Southern California to Central California. We're all on a bus. Pretty rowdy trip going up there. And then there was the shock of getting off the bus once you got there, and all the drill sergeants coming out and starting the yelling process, which was just the beginning of it all. So,
mm-hmm.
But anyway, that was kind of the adventure of getting drafted. I was not either one way or the other way. I wasn't real gung-ho about it, didn't really want to do it, but at the same time, I wasn't going to go to Canada. That was not
mm-hmm.
any realm of possibility. I just wasn't interested in that.
Right.
I just kept thinking in the back of my mind that I'm not going to have to go to Vietnam. I'm smarter than that. They're going to make me a truck driver or have me be a mechanic or something because I'm smart.
Mm-hmm. Right, sir. Okay. Well, I guess the next thing is if you could talk about what BASIC was like for you, and if you could talk about just the daily routine of BASIC and what it was like for you.
BASIC training at Fort Ord, it's exactly what Fort Ord was. It was essentially a combat training facility.
Okay.
It was built. Fort Ord was originally developed and designed in World War II. Most of the buildings at Fort Ord were temporary buildings that were built during World War II, specifically for training. It was as I mentioned before, it's on the Central Coast. It's right on Monterey Bay, which is very much a tourist attraction now. The one thing that we always used to joke about during the process of basic training was there's only one day a week where it's not foggy, and that's Sunday. And you could almost count on that. The fog would roll in, you couldn't see your hand in front of your face, and it was that way every day. It was the Army has a tendency to build their facilities in the crummiest places they can find. And you would think that Monterey would be a beautiful place, which it is,
uh-huh.
but the spot that they put it on is where all the fog goes. So it was inherently a foggy place.
Mm-hmm.
When we arrived there, they put us into reception area barracks. Keep in mind now, these are mainly guys that I went to high school with.
Okay.
So I knew a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
We were at that point still in civilian clothes, and we were all kind of waiting and going through the process. They'd get us up early in the morning and take us someplace. You went through the process of going and getting uniforms. You went through the process of going and getting paperwork. You went through the process of going and getting your shots. Mm-hmm. They'd line us up in a formation in the morning, do a roll call, make sure everybody was there, and then march us off.
Mm-hmm.
I got drafted. Interesting. The day before I went into the Army, we had a party at my mom's house,
mm-hmm.
and towards that evening, we all came inside to watch Neil Armstrong step on the moon.
Mm, right.
And the following day is the day I went in the Army. So huh. That's how I remember the dates.
Right.
At any rate, when during the process of all of this being during a July time frame, you would think it would be nice and warm. Well, it wasn't. It was foggy and cold most of the time. The people I went through, keeping in mind in basic training, one of the things they do, the drill sergeants come in, you're getting yelled at all the time. They're in the process, and the military has a very good way of doing this, they're in the process of tearing you down. That's essentially what they're doing. They're going to tear you down and make you where you don't feel like you're a human being anymore.
Right.
That's the goal in the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And they were doing a pretty good job of it at that point, keeping in mind that these are all people that I grew up with. We were all pretty good friends. And there were some that I knew in high school. I knew of them. I knew their names. I'd say hi to them. But I didn't associate real close to them. Well, when you're going through a process like this, you become, you try and you search out people that you can talk to, and you have some, you look for those common things to try to get a, I won't say get around, but at least have some communications with someone that you can discuss things with.
Mm-hmm.
You can't talk to a drill sergeant.
Yes, sir.
So at any rate, a couple of these guys that I went up with, you know, we had our conversations at night in the barracks, and one of the days, this is in the very beginning, we had to do KP, which pretty much everybody has to do, peeling potatoes, all of the good fun stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they found out that day that it was my birthday.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I went into the Army, and 6 days later, it was my birthday.
Mm-hmm.
So we were all in the reception center, obviously very down at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And during the process, one of these guys that I'd gone to high school with went and stole out of the kitchen a complete sheet of brownies.
Uh-huh.
And they made that my birthday cake.
Right.
So we all ate the brownies, and I remember they ditched the pan underneath the front stairs of that barracks.
Uh-huh.
It's probably still there. But anyway, that was my birthday party for that year. I turned 20
right
on that day. So I got drafted when I was 19, but I turned 20 right away. So mm-hmm. I was actually 20 years old at that point.
Yes, sir.
Well, it turns out about 2 or 3 days later, the guy that went and stole all the brownies disappeared.
Mm.
And come to find out, him and another guy who I'd gone to high school with just couldn't take it. And they wound up going up to Canada.
Okay.
So they deserted.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a little bit of that going on at that time. I don't know what their process was. But, again, it was something I just never considered doing.
Mm-hmm.
Once we got past the reception, we got into the actual basic training part of it. It was very difficult, especially for a young, skinny kid who was not athletically inclined to keep up with some of the others. We had to do our running. We spent a lot of time running, spent a lot of time doing push-ups, spent a lot of time doing physical PT. It was every day. During the course of basic training, you learn how to shoot a weapon, you learn how to take care of yourself, but during this whole process, you're going through a tearing down, so you no longer become an individual, and yet at the same time, you're learning that you have to depend on and be depended on to perform functions,
mm-hmm.
and you have to do that as a group. And I look back on it now, and I see what they were doing during that time frame. And now I can say how important that was a little further down the road in
right.
my career in the military. And it was difficult, extremely difficult. I don't look back now. I don't know how I ever got through it, but I did.
Mm-hmm.
And we all came out of that a much tighter unit, but not so much individuals. During this whole time frame, I'm in the back of my mind thinking, okay, they're going to figure out I'm a mechanic and I know how to drive, so they're going to make me some kind of truck driver or something. Well, when the end of basic training came up, there was a sheet posted on the wall that said what your next duty assignment was going to be. I went and looked at it, and I can't specifically remember now, but the 11B designation was infantry. And mine was different. It didn't say 11B10. It said 11B20 or something like that. And I thought, well, that's a good thing, because that means maybe I'm not going to be infantry. Well, when we went to advanced infantry training, guess what? That's where I went to, and I was considered designated infantry. But again, during all that process of going through AIT, which is the next step of your basic training, I kept thinking, I'm smarter than this. They're going to figure out, you know, I can drive a truck or I can be a mechanic. I won't have to worry about Vietnam. Well, advanced infantry training is basically basic training over again in more depth and detail.
Okay.
And I wound up taking my AIT also at Fort Ord. So all I had to do was move from the lower barracks to the upper barracks, and now we're in AIT.
Mm-hmm.
And AIT was, like I mentioned before, just basically a basic training glorified. We went through the same kinds of scenarios, but since we'd already gone to the basic and we were now a team, we performed in a little different atmosphere in AIT. But more intense training, more learning, more in-depth detail than it was in basic training. Basic training was for everybody. Everybody went through basic training. The second step in the process, which was your advanced training, if you were going to be a medic, if you were going to be a truck driver, if you were going to be a mechanic, you went to a different advanced training scenario. Infantry training went to AIT. The rest of the folks went off to different places to do different types of training, artillery, whatever it happened to be. But I was in AIT. I did advanced infantry training. Once we got out of that, graduated the last day of AIT, we got our, you know, our designations for where we were going to go, and they were posted on the wall, great big letters. I was headed to Vietnam.
Right. And what was your reaction at that point?
The same reaction I had to everything with the military. I'm smarter than this. They'll get me over there. They'll figure out I know how to drive a truck, or I'm a mechanic, and that's what I'll do. And I guess I just wasn't being realistic as to where I was going to be and what I was going to do. But I just kept thinking that, you know, there's no way I'm going to wind up being in a combat situation. And I guess maybe I was just trying to convince myself it wasn't going to be as bad as it was. Turns out, when I got over there, we went to a reception area in Vietnam, in Ben Hoa, which was a little bit a ways from Saigon. And they ran us through a process there, which was basically familiarization with the customs and the territory, and I think they were mainly trying to get us acclimated to the heat. I got there in December, which was the dry season. And which was, I guess, fortunate. I got there on the 15th of December, which was just before Christmas, so it wasn't exactly the best time, but hey, I got drafted just before my birthday, so what can I say? So it was kind of a festive atmosphere. I guess they had the Christmas lights up and stuff. You thought a lot about home at that time, but, you know, I had celebrated my Christmas before I left, and Mm-hmm. It was just kind of a sad, mixed emotions time. But I just kept thinking, well, I won't have to go out in the field. They'll figure out something to do with me.
Mm-hmm.
We were there about a week or two, and then got our assignment orders, and they assigned me to 1st Cav.
Mm-hmm.
So I wound up going with the 1st Cavalry Division. And they gave us the orders and then shipped us off to the 1st Cav training headquarters.
Okay.
And there they put us through the whole scenario of, okay, this is how you shoot, this is what you shoot at. They, Air Cav, our 1st Cavalry Division at that time was air mobile, so we were going to fly on helicopters, which was kind of neat. I thought that was kind of cool, but we were going to be flying on helicopters, and they wanted us to know how to rappel. So they had this 50-foot tower with ropes on it, and they would, you'd build your own little harness, put a couple D-rings on it, hook yourself up to this rope, and they'd make you jump off of it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've never had a real fondness for heights, and so they made us climb up this rope ladder to get to the top of it, and then hook up and jump. And I can remember being scared to death, absolutely scared to death, but I did it. I jumped. And I remember when I got to the bottom and I got unhooked, there was a sergeant standing there, and he looked at me and said, "Do you want to do it again?" And my response was, "Are you crazy?" So this was our first getting accustomed to at least what it was going to be like. One of the things I remember was one of the nights I had to pull guard duty, and there was we were in a pretty secure location. We didn't realize at the time, but it was a pretty secure location where we were.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but yet they wanted us to get acclimated, so they had us go out and do guard duties. I was walking down this little road, and I can remember as I'm walking along, flares going off, because they used illumination flares a lot there.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember watching the flares going off, and then all of a sudden hearing something and panicking. Now, since we were inside a fairly large facility, they gave us an M16, but they didn't give us any ammo.
Okay.
I guess they didn't want anybody shooting anybody.
Right.
So we're walking around with no ammo, unloaded weapon, but we got a weapon. Well, I heard noise and didn't know quite what to do. And so I'm looking, trying to see what it is, and then I realized it was a rat. So just kind of a funny thing that happened. And I remember after I got done with guard duty, there wasn't a whole lot to do, so I went over to the movie theater, outside movie theater, and I watched The Green Berets.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I remember first time I ever seen that movie.
Right.
And I remember watching that in Vietnam and the reactions to the different things that went on in the movie and the laughs and things that were going on, because a lot of the guys that were there at that point had been out in the field already. I hadn't. But that was our experience at the 1st Cav training facility.
Mm-hmm.
After about 2 weeks there, I remember having Christmas dinner there in the mess hall, and typical Christmas dinner. But it didn't feel like Christmas. It was too hot.
Mm-hmm.
It just didn't feel like Christmas to me at all. Which I guess was probably a good thing. But then I got the official orders, and they assigned me the unit I was going to be on. And they put us on, there was about three or four of us going to the same unit that day. And so they loaded us up in a helicopter, flew us out to a LZ, or landing zone, which is where the company was at that particular time. They were on an LZ. And we landed on the LZ and walked over to where the commanding officer was and introduced ourselves. And he basically pulled in a couple of sergeants that were in the platoons that we were going to be in and assigned us to those platoons. And that was about the point that reality set in.
Okay.
And I realized, I'm not going to be a mechanic. I'm not going to be driving a truck. I'm going to be a grunt.
Right.
And that's at that point, we were told, okay, guys, guess what? We're going back to Quan Loy, and we're going to pull guard duty at Quan Loy. And everybody's going, yay, yay. And I went, oh, that sounds boring.
Right.
But they flew us back to a, that same day, flew us back to a large, secure place called Quan Loy, which was an airstrip. And it had bunkers, permanent bunkers. And we pulled guard duty there over the New Year's. And I can remember New Year's Eve sitting on top of a bunker, and everybody's talking about going down to the local bar that they had in Quan Loy itself, and who was going to get to go. And I remember going, well, you know, I'm the new guy. Why don't you guys go? And I'll pull guard duty, because I didn't care to do that anyway. So I wound up pulling guard duty that night. And I remember when they got back, they said, well, why don't you go down there for a little bit? So I walked up there, and it was a pretty rowdy place.
Right.
I walked in the door, took a look around, turned around, walked back, and went back and pulled guard duty the rest of the night.
Right.
But anyway, that was my first experience in Vietnam.
All right. Before really getting into your duties and in the unit and your impressions of the unit, if we could back up for just a moment, you could talk about your experience of the actual trip over there to Vietnam and what that was like for you.
Long time sitting in one place. when we left Fort Ord, they bused us up to Travis Air Force Base, which was about an hour, hour and a half north of Fort Ord.
Okay.
And we all wound up at Travis Air Force Base, and if I remember correctly, that's where they issued the uniforms. Now, I may be wrong on that. It may have been at Fort Ord, but it actually at Oakland, because that's where we went initially. And I think they issued the uniforms in Oakland. And we sat in Oakland for about 2 days.
Okay.
And they kept lining us up in formation and telling us that we were going to get a bed.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd stand there for 3 hours.
Huh.
And then they'd decide, okay, time to go to the mess hall. They'd take us to the mess hall. We'd eat. We'd come back, stand in formation. And they'd say, okay, we're going to get you a place where you can sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd stand there for 3 hours again. This went on for quite a while. Well, they finally got us into, like, I'd call a huge warehouse area. And we finally got a bunk. And I can remember laying there. The lights never went off. There was always people moving, coming and going. Always people talking. And I can remember laying there with my arm over my eyes trying to sleep. And it was just, everybody was just waiting. We were just waiting. There's no other way to put it. Everything had been done. We were just waiting for our turn to get on a plane to go.
Right.
And eventually we got to the point where they said, okay, it's time. They took us up to Travis, sat us down in a, I'm going to call it an airport lobby. It was a lot bigger area than that. But they sat us all down. We had all of our jungle fatigues on at that point. We were essentially ready to go. And we sat there for hours waiting for a plane. And finally the plane landed and they took us out, and it was, I'm going to say it was Trans World Airlines. It wasn't TWA, but it was something like that.
Okay.
But it was an off airlines, but it was a commercial jetliner. It wasn't a military airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And they loaded us all on that. Everybody's wearing jungle fatigues, so we're all OD green. And they actually had stewardesses on the airplane, which was kind of unique. I can remember it being very rowdy initially, but things quieted down after about an hour or two, and they flew us into Hawaii.
Okay.
We landed in Honolulu about the same time the sun was going down, so we got to watch the sunset in Hawaii. And I remember stepping off the plane in Hawaii, and I'd never been there, and how hot and humid it was. And I thought, this is kind of neat, you know, this is a neat place. I can remember walking through a gift shop area, and then basically not having a lot of time there. load us all back on the plane again. I think all they did was refuel. And then we took off, and we flew again. And I can remember at that point it was dark. And I, the whole thing was dark. You couldn't see out the window. You couldn't see anything. We landed in Manila.
Okay.
And everybody got off the airplane again. And I'm sure they refueled. And I can remember sitting inside and looking at the Christmas decorations on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking, a lousy time to go to
Vietnam. Right.
They got us back on the plane again. And we took off, and still dark, flew. And as we were approaching the coast, they announced that we were getting close to Benoit. And mm-hmm. that we'd be landing in however long it was. And everybody's looking out the windows, and I can remember seeing... Now I know what they were. At that time, I didn't know what they were. But I remember seeing what I thought looked like bombs going off.
Mm-hmm.
Bright flashes of light. All up and down the coast. And I'm thinking, ooh, this doesn't look like it's going to be fun.
Mm-hmm.
And what it was the illumination rounds that they were shooting off.
Right.
Could have been some artillery rounds going off, too. But that's basically what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can remember when we landed... And the first thing I remember is stepping off the plane and the smell.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you get hit with the humidity. It was very, very early morning. The sun was just coming up. So we essentially flew from Hawaii to there at nighttime.
Right.
Even though it was a 21-hour airplane flight.
Mm-hmm.
And we, if I remember correctly, we lost a day in this process because the date changes. You go across the international date line. So we lost a day. Process.
Right, yes, sir.
So, as we landed, and you get this blast of heat, and you get this smell,
mm-hmm.
and essentially what the smell is the combination of the diesel fumes from all of the vehicles,
mm-hmm.
and the burning of diesel fuel,
mm-hmm.
and later on, I discovered where that basically comes from, when your latrines were half of a 55-gallon drum, half filled with diesel fuel,
mm-hmm.
and you did your thing in those latrines, and then when they got to the point that they were saturated, they'd light them on fire and burn them,
mm-hmm.
and burn it off.
Right, yes, sir.
And that's what you were smelling,
mm-hmm.
was primarily that aroma and then the diesel fuel from the engines running.
Mm-hmm.
So that first impression as you step off the plane is pretty overwhelming, and it's something you never forget. And in talking to a number of people that have gone through the experience, they all pretty much have the same feeling,
mm-hmm.
the humidity and the stink.
Right. Yes, sir. Yeah, and most of the other veterans that I've interviewed, that's one of the main things they mention as well. So, yes, sir. Yep. All right. Well, getting back to once you got to your unit, if you could talk a little bit about, you said you were based at Quan Loi?
The... 1st Cavalry Division at that point was based out of Quan Loi.
So okay.
All the main headquarters were
mm-hmm.
there.
Okay.
Now, that area, anyone that's familiar with the Vietnam area, that's in an area that was essentially called the Fish Hook.
Mm-hmm.
It would be northeast of Saigon and fairly close to the Cambodian border. So the area of Quan Loi had a number of different names, different terms that were used for it. Rocket City was one of them. It was close to An Loc. An Loc was one of the big battles after the U.S. had pulled out of Vietnam. It's one of the big areas that the North Vietnamese ran into. An Loc was the village that supported Quan Loi. Quan Loi was, again, it was an air base. It was essentially a landing strip.
Okay.
Fairly small landing strip. We thought it was huge, but in reality it was a fairly small landing strip. They couldn't get a whole lot of aircraft on it. There was one four-prop airplane that sat at the end of the runway that I can vividly remember. They were working on it, and it sat at the very end of the runway, which was kind of interesting because there was no hangar. That particular aircraft turns out back in October, November time frame, Quan Loi got a rocket attack.
Mm-hmm.
And that aircraft was sitting there getting ready to take off, and a rocket hit it and destroyed part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they were doing, was repairing that. And they called that the Queen of Quan Loi. And it was there the whole time I remember it mm-hmm. being there. I don't know if they ever got it off the ground again. But that was kind of an interesting spot. When we first got there, or when I first got there, the unit was there doing what was called green line duty. We were pulling guard duty.
Mm-hmm.
And we were put into one segmented area. And what Quan Loi essentially was originally, it's surrounded by rubber groves, rubber plantations.
Mm-hmm.
And it was French. It was
right.
developed by the French. It's actually part of the Michelin tire companies back in the old days.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they did. They had rubber trees, and people went out and processed, got the rubber out of the trees, and that's what they did there.
Mm-hmm.
Quan Loi, being built by the French, had large mansions that the French owned and lived in. And then the workers basically lived in the Anlock area and then went out into these rubber plantations to get the rubber. There was a rather large, elaborate swimming pool that the military obviously used.
Mm-hmm.
It had gotten rebuilt, and at that point I remember seeing it. I remember going over and looking at it. I never got to use it. I wasn't there long enough. But the headquarters for 1st Cav at that time was all done in temporary tent-type buildings that were constructed throughout these rubber plantations that were within the wire at Quan Loi.
Mm-hmm.
And we had civilians that came in through gates to get inside. There was a large artillery group that worked at one end of Quan Loi that fired huge guns.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when we were out in the field, and we were on LZs, we saw, usually it was 105 howitzers. Once in a while, if we were on a fairly large LZ, they'd bring 155s out. Well, there were 8-inch guns that were sitting at Quan Loi. There was huge artillery out there. A lot of helicopters coming in and out all the time. And occasionally a plane, fixed-wing aircraft, would land at Quan Loi on a fairly regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a busy place, quite a few people there. A number of people were stationed there on a permanent basis. I wasn't one of those. I only got to pull guard duty there a couple times.
Okay.
But it was what we consider to be a large facility, but in reality it wasn't. It was a fairly small facility, but interesting place. Very
mm-hmm.
interesting place.
All right. Let's see. After pulling guard duty at Quan Loi, at that point, were you sent to different fire base areas, or how were you? How did you operate it from?
We were at Quan Loi till, I don't have the exact date, but I'm going to say it was like the 3rd or 4th of January.
Okay.
And doing guard duty.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were told, okay, saddle up, you're going out in the field.
Mm-hmm.
And what we did is we got all our equipment ready and then went down to the main airstrip, and they had helicopters,
mm-hmm.
A number of helicopters there, and we would break into groups of about 8 people
okay.
and go out and get on these helicopters. And the helicopters, we were told at that time we were going to the field, so they were going to CA us in, combat assault us in. And obviously, this was a very apprehensive time since I've never gone through it.
Mm-hmm.
I'd been fortunately assigned to a platoon that had a senior platoon leader, somebody, a sergeant that had been in country for, at that time, about 8 months.
Okay.
And knew what he was doing. He'd been in a small portion of the unit called the Killer Team. He knew his stuff and knew it very well, so I was extremely fortunate being with him. Turns out he was from Anaheim, so another California guy.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a pretty good relationship. I mean, we could talk quite a bit about home and stuff. But he was one of those people that would sit you down and say, okay, here's how it is.
Right.
And you know, that was probably the biggest, most important thing that happened during my time there. So he kind of alluded to what we were going to be doing and how we were going to do it, what we were supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
So we all got on the helicopter, took off, and we were like the third group going in, so we missed the initial part of a combat assault, but we flew into a fairly large grassy area.
Okay.
Keeping in mind it's still dry season, so there wasn't a whole lot of water in places.
Right.
But the grass was probably knee high. They landed the helicopter. We jumped off and maneuvered our way out to the tree line, which is what he told us to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then we all kind of got down and just kind of kept our eyes open to see if anything was going to happen. Once the last group got in, the whole company was now in the area.
Okay.
The whole perimeter where the helicopters had been landing were surrounded by our group. So
mm-hmm.
we now had a pretty secure area. At that point, all the helicopters were gone. Everything got quiet. And that was my first experience being in the field.
Mm-hmm.
We were now in an area where you couldn't talk above a whisper.
Mm-hmm.
The idea was to keep everything quiet. No noise. Just minimum noise. And we tried very hard not to get ourselves grouped into where there's 5 or 10 people standing in a group.
Mm-hmm.
You always try to keep yourself separate. So we, at that point, started out marching. And by marching, it's entirely different than what you envision. We had a point man.
Mm-hmm.
We had a man behind the point man.
Right.
And then spaced probably, I won't use military terms here, probably about 6 to 10 yards apart.
Mm-hmm.
The point man would lead and everybody would follow, and you'd have a group of about 110 people
mm-hmm.
stacked up behind him, following him down the area that he was walking. One of the things we were trying not to do at that point is to use any existing trails. We were trying to always make our own trail.
Mm-hmm.
It turned out to be much better to try to stay off the trails if we could, just because we didn't want to run into people.
Okay.
So this was in the afternoon, late afternoon, so we didn't walk real far. I'm going to say maybe 1,000 kilometers.
Okay.
At the very furthest. And the sun, Vietnam, being as it's close to the equator, the time is sun up and sun down, pretty much stays the same time every day.
Mm.
It doesn't vary like it does when you're in North America. So when the sun comes up, it comes up about 7 o'clock in the morning. The sun goes down about 6 at night.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty consistent. It doesn't change from year to year or during the course of the year. It's always pretty much the same times.
Mm-hmm.
So what we always used to try to do is we'd stop when there's enough sunlight to allow yourself to put out a poncho liner, put out your air mattress, make yourself a little something to eat with your sea rations, eat your dinner, get yourself set up for the night before the sun went down.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because once the sun went down, and this is something that Bill Belcher was my platoon sergeant.
Okay.
Bill sat us down and said, okay, here's some things that are going to happen. And so just be prepared. It's going to get dark. It's going to get darker than you've ever seen in your whole life. You won't be able to see your hand in front of your face, and I'm not exaggerating.
Mm-hmm.
You won't see anything. You need to get from where you're sleeping out to this little berm where we have the Claymore Mine clickers, and that's where you're going to sit, and you're going to stay awake,
mm-hmm.
and you're going to pull guard duty during the night. When you get done and your time's up, you're going to have to get from that point back to the next guy and wake him up.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then you're going to sit there and wait until he's up and going out to that point. Then you have to go back to where you're sleeping, find it, and you can go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it's going to work. And you're not going to fall asleep. No matter what you do, you're not going to fall asleep.
Right.
Because you have to wake the next guy up.
Right.
So he said, here's what I'm going to have you do. And he had us take pieces of bamboo and make ourselves a little trail out to the hole where we were going to have to pull guard duty,
mm-hmm.
and then back, and then put a diversion to get us to the next guy to wake the next guy up.
Okay.
so that we could get to and from where we slept without having to see anything, because you couldn't see anything.
Right.
And that's the way he set us up the first night. So, sure enough, and I don't remember what time it was, but it was dark. Mm-hmm. They woke me up, and I had to climb out to the hole and sit there and pull guard duty. And it was our guard duty when I was actually doing that portion of it was about an hour.
Okay.
And, you know, keep looking at my watch, which fortunately had illuminated hands so I could see them.
Mm-hmm.
And when my hour was up, I went over, woke the next guy up, made sure he went out. When I went over, and I went back to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
The next morning, the sun's coming up, and it had just barely broken dawn. And I'm laying there, I'm awake, and I'm laying there on my air mattress, and all of a sudden I hear somebody yelling at the top of their lungs. Couldn't tell what they were yelling, but they were yelling something. At about that time, a Claymore went off.
Mm-hmm.
And then the trip flares start going off. And I'm grabbing my M16. Bill's telling everybody what to do, because at that time we had about 3 new guys in our platoon.
Right.
And he's telling everybody what to do. And turns out, in one of the other platoons, one of the new guys, a black guy named Rabbit,
mm-hmm.
was nicknamed Rabbit, got lost.
Okay.
And he got out past the trip flares and then decided he was lost, and he sat down. And he waited till the sun came up the next morning. And as he's coming in, he tripped over one of the trip flare wires, set the trip flare off, and so he started yelling, telling him he was a GI. Well, one of the guys there saw the trip flare go off, he could hear somebody yelling, but couldn't tell what he was saying, and he blew the Claymore.
Oh, no.
Fortunately, since he'd fallen down, the Claymore went over his head and missed him.
Right.
And he actually got sent to the rear and never came to the field again, so... not exactly sure what happened, but I'm sure it shook him up bad enough that that's the reason he never came back. But that was my first night in the field.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Okay. All right. Well, before getting into more specific memories of combat and of being out in the field, let me ask you this: if you could talk for a few minutes about your first impressions of the unit. I know you've talked about Sergeant Bill Belcher, but how about some of the other guys? You don't have to mention specific names if you don't want to, but just the dynamic of the unit itself.
Okay. Well, keeping in mind that when I got drafted, I went over with basically my whole high school class. By the time we had divvied up AIT and gotten orders to go to Vietnam and then got assigned to units in Vietnam, that group was dissipated.
Right.
The people I went to First Cav with, I knew one guy.
Okay.
And it was somebody I'd gone through basic training with. But we had essentially disbanded at that point. So when I got to the unit, I didn't know anybody. These were all new people to me. Having gone through basic and AIT, I knew what we had to do. I knew what I had to do. And so, you know, I started making sure that I listened to what other people, especially senior people, told me, and tried to find and search out those senior people so I could learn as much as I could about what it was we were going to have to do. And tried to form my own core group of individuals to work with.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, when you're working in a unit that's essentially a group of 100 and some odd people that are as the company, and being out in the field and divided as you are, you don't get to know everyone in the company that well.
Right.
You get to maybe recognize faces just because you've watched them walk past you,
mm-hmm.
but you've never had a chance to work or talk with a lot of the people. You get more in tune with your platoon, which is a group of roughly 30 people,
okay.
30 to 35 people. And you get to know them better because you're working closer with them. Platoon is broken down into 3 more squad units. And these squad units you get to know really well because you, you're working with within your squad on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
These are the people that you're going to sleep with, you're going to eat with, you're going to play cards with, you're going to talk to. You get to know them pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
Also, when you're on the LZs, when you're out of the field or out of the boonies, as I'll say, you work with them.
Mm-hmm.
You're out putting concertina up with them. You're always working with this core group of about 5 to 10 people. And you learn what their hometown is. You learn if they've got girlfriends. You learn they've got wives. You get more in tune to them.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I had that group of people that I worked pretty close with. We had one guy that was from Rhode Island.
Okay.
Nickname was TJ, and he was an M60 gunner. He carried the M60 gun, and I actually initially was assigned to him as an ammo bearer.
Okay.
And I did what the term was hump the M60 rounds.
Right.
I carried two bandoliers, actually three bandoliers of M60 rounds, kind of in the Pancho Villa style,
uh-huh.
You know, the cross across your chest kind of thing.
Right, yes, sir.
Plus I carried my own M16, plus I carried my own backpack, at that time I think I was carrying 4 quarts of water, 7 days of rations, air mattress, poncho liner, 2 bandoliers of M16 rounds, usually 3 to 4 cans of soda stuffed in my pockets.
Right.
So that's what we carried.
Right.
And when we get up, we walk out and carry that with us every day.
Mm-hmm.
That's what everybody did. So
uh-huh.
We were all common. There wasn't people that didn't carry anything. Everybody did, from the commanding officer all the way down. Within this small core group of people, you learned to share.
Mm-hmm.
There were going to be things that you didn't care for in the sea rations that you would pass off to somebody else that did like them.
Mm-hmm.
And they would sit down with you and, hey, I got an idea, let's mix this with this. And you'd learn how to cook.
Right.
There were certain things you did that within this group to try to learn. And keeping in mind my mentality, I didn't want to carry M60 rounds, especially after the first firefight.
Okay.
I'll progress a little bit, and I'll keep it within the core groups that you understand a little bit
sure.
About where I'm coming from.
Sure.
I'm carrying M60 rounds for an M60 gunner. We had been in the field at that point for close to a month,
mm-hmm.
And we had been our platoon. Had been assigned to work with the 11th Armored Cavalry Division riding on tanks.
Okay.
Which, that's kind of cool. You know, all us walking around and stuff, and now we get to ride for a while.
Right.
The only problem is, having been in an infantry unit for so long and not wanting noise, the track units didn't care about noise.
Mm-hmm.
They were loud. I mean, what are you going to do? You can't muffle a diesel engine. So,
right.
They didn't mind the noise. We weren't used to that at that point. So it was a little bit scary. The other thing was, we're used to being separated. We're used to being quiet, moving quiet, being separated, not sitting with other people. When you're riding on tanks, you're making a lot of noise, and you're on that track.
Mm-hmm.
You're in one place, and you can't get away from it fast enough. Our job was, if you get hit, disappear. Get off the track and get out there as fast as you can, but get away from that track. That was our job.
Right.
And then the tracks were there to do the damage that they had to do, but we were just riding along for the ride, basically.
Mm-hmm.
They took us out into the rubber plantations for the evening and left us in a spot, and then they took off. So we're up on this little rise in a rubber plantation.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a lot different than the jungle, because in a rubber plantation, you can see. You can look and you can see down the rows of trees for
right.
A significant distance,
mm-hmm.
And see movement. You can see if somebody else is around you. So kind of a good thing, but at the same time, there's no place to hide. So we're there that evening, and we're all talking, and I'm talking to TJ, the 60 gunner, and we're just kind of having a good time. And somebody had a camera, so he's taking pictures. And during the course of that evening, the radio operator, our platoon, our squad radio guy was there. And I just happened to pick up his radio pack and strap it on my back, and I'm sitting there playing with the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy that had the camera snapped a picture. I have that picture.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, in the picture you can see TJ standing next to me.
Okay.
So we were just kind of taking it easy, having a good time that evening. And as the sun went down that night, and we're all doing guard duty and stuff, somebody noticed that there was a fire. And it was quite a ways away from us, but there was a fire down in this ravine.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought, well, maybe it's from artillery or something, you know, because we didn't hear anybody. So the next morning, the sun's coming up, and our Kit Carson scout, who was a mountain yard, which is one of the indigenous tribe members,
mm-hmm.
in Vietnam.
Right.
So he's Vietnamese. And we used him as an interpreter and a guide. He went outside the perimeter to do his business in the morning,
mm-hmm.
and got outside the perimeter, and as he's sitting there, he sees some movement out in front of him, and sees something in black, which isn't good.
Right.
So he comes running back in as fast as he can come in, yelling, "There's gooks down the hill, there's gooks down the hill."
Uh-huh.
And about that time, everything broke loose.
Right.
So I'm there, and Bill's in the area of me, and he starts yelling at me, because this is the first firefight that I've been in.
Mm-hmm.
He's yelling at me, "Get the 60 ammo out to TJ.
Mm-hmm.
Get the 60 ammo out to TJ." Well, they'd caught us at such a point. I'm probably 10, 20 meters away from where my M60 rounds are.
Mm.
So I had to crawl out to get the M60 rounds and bring them back to the gunner.
Okay.
So I get the 60 rounds back to the gunner, and about the time we're getting loaded up and getting ready to shoot, we start hearing people yelling, "Stop, hold fire, hold your fire. Friendlies, friendlies, hold your fire." So everything kind of stops, and then it comes back to us that there was a group of popular forces, which were the Vietnamese friendlies, that were down the hill from us. The only problem was nobody had communicated this. So we didn't know they were there. They didn't know we were there.
Right.
So they just happened to see us, and we happened to see them, and we all started shooting at each other.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, nobody got hurt.
Right.
But at the end of this, I can remember standing up and looking at the rubber trees in my immediate area and seeing holes and rubber coming out of the holes,
mm-hmm.
about 3 feet up off the ground. So from that experience, I learned you need to get down as low as you can get.
Right,
when
something
sure. starts happening.
Mm-hmm.
But fortunately, nobody got hurt. That was a good thing. But that was the day that I decided that maybe carrying M60 rounds wasn't the best job in the world, that maybe that radio had some good qualities to it. Maybe there was a reason I should be doing that instead.
Mm-hmm.
So I made my decision that day I'm going to carry a radio.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what changed my job in Vietnam from then on out. Because I said, "Hey, I want to do this," and everybody said, "You're nuts." Because they're going to shoot the radio guy first, because that big old antenna is sticking up on the radio.
Right.
And I said, "Yeah, but the radio guys don't have to walk around as much. And if there's a firefight, we don't have to get involved in going out and moving around. We just sit down with the radio and talk."
Right.
So anyway, that's what I wound up changing to officially that day. Now I was going to be a radio operator.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. Let me ask you about, given that it was this late in the war, 69 and going into 70, what was morale like among the guys?
This was towards the end of, it was after the major battles. It was after the Tet Offensive, which is kind of where the turning point was, if you go through the history books.
Mm-hmm, right.
The Tet Offensive happened over a year earlier than when I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, at that point, the popularity of the old war went in the toilet, and everybody was against it, and all the protests were started.
Mm-hmm.
Things were not the easiest on soldiers at that point, even though I always looked at it, hey, I'm just doing my job.
Mm-hmm.
But the morale in our group, the morale within the division and the company I was in, was good.
Mm-hmm.
We all kind of mutually came to an unspoken agreement at that point that we're here, we're doing this, and somehow we all got to get home.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to do what we have to do to make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And we obviously at that point were not, we didn't want to make contact. We didn't want to go out and find them,
mm-hmm.
Even though that was what we did. I mean, we went out in the field. We were actively searching. But our whole concept was to try to avoid contact as best as we could. And I think we all did a pretty good job of that. These are very, very difficult situations. I mean, they're about as worst, the worst, lowest position you can possibly get within the military is being a grunt. And that's what we were. We were grunts. We were the low life. We were the guys who were out in the field getting shot at daily. And we just all came to the basic concept that, we got to get out of this. We've got to do what we've got to do. Do it to the best of our ability, but we have to work together, because if we don't, people are going to get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
The idea was to try to eliminate that. We did the best we possibly could to make sure that the guy on either side of us was going to come home.
Right.
Yeah, that's the way we worked together. And as far as a morale standpoint, I think that's what kept us going.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what made it work for us. During television and stuff, and a lot of documentaries, you see all the drug problems and stuff.
Right.
And yes, there were drugs there.
Mm-hmm.
First one to tell you that there were. The primary drug at that point that I ever saw was marijuana. There was a significant use, I'm going to say, of marijuana off on the LZs. Never, ever did I see it in the field.
Okay.
Ever. It just wasn't done.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a mutual agreement amongst everybody. When you're in the field, you don't do that. And mm-hmm. if you get back on the LZs and you're not pulling guard duty, you do what you do.
Right.
And the officers knew it. They knew it. They were aware of it. I'm not going to say that they wouldn't have done something if it was done in front of them, but they avoided situations where they would be exposed to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was there, but I never saw any heavy drug use ever.
Mm-hmm.
When I was there. Saw it after. I saw it when I got home.
Mm-hmm.
But I never saw it when I was there.
Right.
I'm sure on the larger basis, when you got into it, it may have been in Quan Loi, even though I never saw it. But I think maybe in the secure areas it was more prevalent. But grunt infantry units at that point, we had reasonable morale. Drug use was none in the field, at least that I ever saw.
Mm-hmm.
On the LZs, yeah, marijuana was around, but that was about it. But morale was, for the time that we were there, morale was pretty good for the unit I was in.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. You mentioned the drug issue. What about were there any racial tensions at the time?
It was interesting because there were a number of blacks in our unit,
mm-hmm.
and they tended to hang together.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to say it was more because of interests.
Mm-hmm.
They liked their Motown music,
mm-hmm.
Where I think the white guys in the unit liked other, rock and roll more. They had a tendency to congregate together when we were on the LZs. When we were in the field, we were all one.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I will tell you now, I never saw anything that I saw anyway that would indicate to me that there was any racial tensions. I never saw any fights.
Mm-hmm.
Can't say I saw any harsh words.
Right.
I just didn't see it. And maybe I was oblivious to it, but I don't think I was. I think I was pretty much in tune to it.
Mm-hmm.
We slept together, we ate together. You know, we just maybe didn't listen to the same music together, but we were around, and they were around, and there. We didn't all socialize or mix in the same group,
mm-hmm.
but yet at the same time, I know when we were out in the field and we were in situations, I never saw anything that would give me any indication at all that there was any racial tension.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. How about other tensions such as lifers versus draftees? Were there any problems there?
There were a few individuals that were, I'm going to say, were more isolated.
Okay.
Maybe kind of wanted to do things their own way.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of hard to describe. They very much sat off on their own. Somebody may say, okay, you're going to pull guard duty from 10 to midnight tonight. They'd go, oh, man, I don't want to do that. I'm going to do that. They had a tendency to get weeded out pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
In a few cases that I can recollect, we might have an individual in the unit that didn't get along with the platoon sergeant for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
And they normally got transferred, maybe to another platoon, maybe out of the company. They tried to minimize that. Usually, they got excluded pretty quick. So we didn't have a lot of that, but there were a few instances that I can think of.
Okay.
Where people were with the unit, seemed to have an attitude, and then they weren't anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the way it went down, and it usually happened pretty quick. We had a pretty good group of guys. We had a pretty strong core group of people that I was with, and we went through a lot of bad times. We went through a lot of stuff.
Yes, sir.
And it probably brought us together pretty close.
Yes, sir.
I would hope so anyway. It's interesting because you go through these scenarios and you go through these situations with people that day in and day out basis, you know, you depend on them for your life and they depend on you for their life. But then when you get out of that situation, you get extracted from it, you just go on with your own life and you don't dwell on it. I mean, there's a lot of people that I was in that situation with when I was there that I was very close with at the time, but I don't know where they live now. I haven't had contact with them. I have a few that I have,
mm-hmm.
but for the most part, you know, they just kind of melted back into civilian life after they got out. But
right.
But yeah, there were a few individuals that didn't stay in the company very long, just because of the way that they wouldn't melt in with everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, getting back to this first firefight that you mentioned, I know you talked about working. Well, first of all, how long had you been in country when this firefight took place?
I was officially with the unit, would have been in January, the very first part of January.
Okay.
Actually, December 28th was the day I was officially assigned to the unit.
Okay.
But the first firefight, the first actual situation that I got into would have been in February, and that's when we were out working with the track unit. So it had been a little over a month.
Mm-hmm.
And during the course of that month, we had been at Quan Lo until probably the end of the first week of January. I think it was around the 8th or 9th of January that we went out in the field the first time.
Okay.
But didn't see any action, as per se, until February time frame, which is, you know, when we got in a fight with the popular forces. We, after that particular incident, nothing really happened. We just spent a lot of time moving around out in the jungle. We found a lot of stuff, found a lot of bunkers, found some munitions, we heard noises, we knew they were around, but we never really got into a contact or firefight well into March. And during that time frame, I can remember vividly all the platoon sergeants, platoon leaders, and up to the commanding officer going, "This isn't good. This isn't good. We're getting way too relaxed. We're getting lackadaisical on how we're doing things. And something's going to happen. When it does, it's going to be bad." Because when you get new people coming in on a regular basis who don't know how to react, nobody really knows for sure what they're going to do when you get into contact until it happens. You don't know how people are going to react to things, and you're depending on them to do things in an appropriate manner. But if nothing happened, you don't know what they're going to do. So that time span of time when nothing was actually happening was scary. And it shook up a lot of people that had been in country for a while, because they knew at some point something was going to happen.
Right.
And when it did, they weren't exactly sure how people were going to react. So it made for a really tense situation until things started coming down. And then when it did, we did good. We did really well, I think. And I'll go back to the senior people that were there at that time. They did a good job of making sure people understood when something happened, what they were supposed to do, and how they were supposed to do it. Now, did they know they were going to do it? No, they had no idea. But they had gone through this enough times with everybody and had people on their toes good enough. So when it did finally come to fruition and things happened, everybody knew what to do, and they did a good job of doing it.
Yes, sir. All right. Well, you mentioned in that first, I guess, that first incidental fire between your unit, between your platoon and the PFs. You mentioned working with a Kit Carson scout. Did you guys always go out in the field with a Kit Carson scout? Or
usually each platoon had their own.
Okay.
Ours was a mountain yard, one of the tribal people named Den. And Den was kind of an interesting character, a little short guy. Spoke good English. I mean, he had a pretty good dialect of English. And had been in the military, or had been in the army at that point for a few years. Had been through a number of combat situations. There were people within our company that had been through combat situations with him and learned to trust him.
Okay.
And that was a big thing. That was really a big thing. Now, as I progressed and I wound up going up through the ranks of operating radios, I wound up being the battalion RTO, or the battalion radio operator, for the company.
Okay.
So I worked really close with the main CP, and I got to know most everybody being in that position. I was no longer with just first platoon. I had to work with all the platoons. And so I got to know all of their Kit Carson scouts a little bit. And there were a couple of them. There was one Kit Carson scout that we had that was new. He'd just gotten transferred in. And I can remember there being conversations about him.
Okay.
People didn't trust him. He made a lot of noise, which is not a good thing. And he would make noise at very inopportune times. And I can remember the platoon sergeant making the comment that he had gone to him once already and told him that he was in a position now he could no longer guarantee his safety. That if he didn't quit making noise and keep things quiet, that he couldn't guarantee him that somebody was going to shoot him.
Right, right.
And I can remember that conversation going down and thinking, ah, it's not a good thing. Maybe we need to get rid of him. And he got transferred out of the unit pretty quick. But that was a pretty common scenario. Because you had to depend on everybody. You couldn't let some just one individual do what they felt like doing. You had to depend on everybody. And if somebody elected on their own not to go under those guidelines, they usually weren't there very long. And that included the Kit Carson Scouts. Interesting thing, go back and talk about Den for a second.
Okay.
We were all sitting in a group one night, and one of the guys had gotten some photos. And keeping in mind it's December Christmas time, he'd gotten some pictures of his family's Christmas time. And one of the photos was taken outside of his house, and he lived on the East Coast, and there was snow, a significant amount of snow. And we're all looking at this picture, and he's passing them around. You know, Den was sitting right there, so he passed him this picture. Den looked at it and handed it to the next guy, and then he reached over and took it back and looked at it again. He kept looking at this picture, and he had a real quizzical look on his face. Somebody asked him, what are you looking at in the picture? And he says, what's the white stuff? What's all the white? Looked at the picture. That's snow. He goes, what's snow?
Right.
And we're all sitting there, and we're all laughing. And somebody looked at him and said, you know the ice? Because we'd get a block of ice when they'd do a log day and we'd get supplies. They would bring us out a block of ice, and we'd take the ice and spin our Coke cans and the soda cans on top of it to cool the soda down because everything was hot.
Right.
And you cool down the soda, and you could have a cold soda. And so we were trying to explain to them, if you took that ice and you shaved it, you know, you take a knife and scrape it, and it makes the white powder, that's like snow.
Right.
But he, for the life of him, could not figure out how it could get cold enough to do that.
Right.
And it was just a very, very interesting conversation with someone that had never seen snow, had no concept of snow, and had never been in an environment where it could even reasonably come close to snowing, could understand how that could be. So it just kind of showed you what you were dealing with. And Den, like I say, Den was a family member. He wound up getting wounded. We got attacked on an LZ one time, and he wound up getting wounded. But he came back to the unit, and he liked working with us. He really liked working with the group of people he was working with, and he was one of the good ones. He was a good Kit Carson Scout. We had a couple others that were okay, but he was the best one we had.
All right. One more question about that first that incidental firefight. You mentioned the rubber coming out of the trees about 3 feet up. I've read in some of the books, and I've heard some people say that because the French still owned a lot of the rubber plantations, if the Americans damaged the rubber trees, that the unit or at least the army would have to pay for those. Did you know if there was any truth to that?
Yeah, I never heard anything. I can tell you for a fact, in Quan Loi, the mansions that were outside the wire at Quan Loi had gaping holes in the roofs.
Okay.
From, who knows, artillery rounds, rockets, whatever. They weren't destroyed, but they were damaged pretty heavily. I had heard, and I don't know this for a fact, but I had heard that they were working some of the rubber plantations. Now, where we were and the directions that we were given, there were two basic core operating modes. One operating mode was in a no-fire zone, which a no-fire zone basically meant if you saw someone and they weren't carrying a weapon or had a weapon, that they were pointing at you, you had to determine if they were friendly or foe.
Right.
And you did that by going up and asking for a card or identification, and you went through a process. I never did that. Mm-hmm. We were never in that situation.
Okay.
We were always in what was called a free fire zone, which free fire zone meant if it moved, you shot it.
Okay.
And so where we were at any given point in time, with even within those rubber plantations, was always a free fire zone.
Mm-hmm.
So my assumption is when you're in a free fire zone, I mean, there's going to be collateral damage no matter what you do. If you're shooting, you're going to hit something.
Right.
So I never heard anything about that. I will agree that I've heard after the fact that that was true, that there was probably some of that that went on.
Okay.
I couldn't tell you for a fact if it did in the given scenario we were in that day or not.
Right.
The rubber plantations were rough. They had at one time or another been cleaned out because the jungle grows back pretty fast, and there was grasses between the trees that stood probably knee-high, maybe a little higher than that. But the trees didn't look like they'd been processed too recently. I mean, you could see a groove in them, which is the way they do it, but the grooves were kind of overgrown. We never saw anybody out there, so I can't say that they, you know, they were or they weren't. My presumption is that they weren't, but I don't know that for a fact. I do know that it was a huge Michelin rubber plantation that the French built, and but I can't say that it was active at that point. Because at that point, at that particular time that we were there anyway, there was a lot of combat activity taking place.
All right.
Can I take a break for a second?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, let me grab some water, and I'll be back in just a second.
Sure, no problem.
Thank you, Jason. Sorry about that.
Not a problem. Not a problem at all. All right. Let's see. Well, one thing.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, all right. Okay, now, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned after this first incidental firefight, it was, things were fairly quiet for a while. How long was it before you actually came into an actual firefight with the enemy, and if you could talk a little bit about that first firefight?
A little bit of my own personal transition during that time, too, because it does make a difference on scenarios as they went down.
Sure, yes, sir.
As I'd mentioned earlier, would have been February time frame, I made the decision that I didn't like humping M60 rounds. That probably wasn't the best job for me. So I made a decision at that time that I wanted to be a radio operator now. In the course of basic training and AIT, that's one of the things that they train you on. And what they do is basically give you the alphabet as it's presented through a radio operator, which is, it's we use a different language. But at any rate, they give you that in basic training. And when we did that, I didn't care for it. It didn't strike me as something that would be fun to do.
Right.
But when I got in Vietnam, things changed pretty quick. You start looking for, okay, what could I do that might be a little bit safer? And yeah, everybody kind of talked about the radio operator having that big antenna, and yeah, you have to carry more weight on your back. And but the first thing I noticed was that the radio operators always seemed to be sitting down. So that's kind of cool. They don't have to get up and walk around.
Right.
The other thing was they didn't go on patrols. Once you got to the level of a CP, or once you, the command post radio operator, you didn't go out on patrols.
Okay.
You only moved with the company. So I thought, that's what I want to do. I need to get to that level. Somehow I need to get up there. So I started out as a squad radio operator. I don't think I did that more than a week.
Okay.
And they made me the platoon radio operator. And it turns out that the platoon radio operator they had moved into the main CP. He now became the company radio operator. So my thought was, all right, I'm going to try to follow him. Follow his guidance and figure out what he does. Turns out he wound up being probably one of the closest friends I had the whole time in Vietnam. So he kind of gave me some guidance as to, okay, here's what you need to do and how you need to do it. So I wound up being a platoon radio operator and did that for maybe a month.
Okay.
Keeping in mind, during this time frame, we were not in contact.
Mm-hmm.
We were just walking around,
mm-hmm.
looking for things, but never really came into contact with the enemy.
Right.
So during that course of time, I thought, you know, this is a pretty cool job. You know, there isn't, I'm just kind of floating along, and it's interesting, different.
Mm-hmm.
I still had to go out on patrols because I'm still at the platoon level, but it's not quite as bad as it was.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then Lefty, who was the guy I was talking about earlier that wound up being one of my best friends,
mm-hmm.
he wound up going into battalion radio operator, which left the company radio operator position open.
Mm-hmm.
And I had done this long enough now that they knew that I knew how to operate the radio well.
Mm-hmm.
So they moved me into the company radio operator position. So now I'm in with the CP.
Okay.
Which means I don't have to go out on patrols anymore. I work with the company. I sit most of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And all I do is I listen to the platoon. The way the system worked was the squad radio operators communicated with the company.
Okay.
With the platoon radio operator.
Right.
The platoon radio operator communicated with the company radio operator, and the company operator worked with the battalion radio operator.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm now in the position of being the company radio operator and getting to work all the inner workings of coordinating who's going to do what, when they're going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing. Still keeping in mind, we hadn't been in a true firefight yet.
Right.
We were sitting on top of a hill. I'm with the main CP, and one of the platoons was out doing a patrol.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, off in the distance, you could hear a pop, 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 pop,
mm-hmm.
which is first sounds of an AK.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first time I'd ever heard an AK go off.
Okay.
Very distinctive, different sound. And so I knew what was happening. Well, about that time, the platoon radio operator called in and said, we're in contact. And by then, everything's going off. You can hear grenade launchers popping. You can hear M16s going off. I mean, they're into the firefight. Well, the battalion radio operator's responsibility is he's the one that calls in airstrikes. He's the one that coordinates all the overhead stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The company radio operator is responsible for making sure the communications channel are open between the company commander and the platoon themselves and coordinating those efforts to make sure that they're being supported from the company level.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I'm having radio conversations and making this happen between the company and the battalion radio operator, who was my good friend, making sure that the airstrikes are coming in. My first firefight was basically, I never fired the M16. I'm
okay.
laying flat on the ground, but I'm talking on a radio.
Okay.
And so I realized at that point, this is what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Because
right.
it's a much safer position to be in. And I liked the idea that I had control.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew what was going on. I knew everything that was going on. Which when you're in a platoon level or a squad level, you don't know. You have no idea what the other guys are doing.
Mm-hmm.
You're only concerned with that group of 5 to 10 to 15 people you're working with. You don't know what the rest of the company's doing.
Right.
And I was at a level now where I knew everything that was going on.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, this is neat. This is fun. You know, much fun as you can have, but at
mm-hmm.
least it's stuff going on. We went through the first firefight, and it only lasted maybe at the very most 2 minutes.
Okay.
And they broke contact. Nothing happened. Nobody got hurt, but they broke contact. And I can remember that evening, my former platoon sergeant came over to me, sat down, and said, well, you weren't in the middle of it, but now you know what it sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
He said, get used to it. And I just said, yeah, I understand what you're saying. Yes, it's scary. So it was, I'm going to say 2, maybe 3 days later, we were in a long line. The whole company was moving, and we're going down an adjacent trail, making our own trail.
Okay.
And all of a sudden, I get a call back on the radio, and in a very hushed tone, I hear, "We're stopping. There's a machine gun set up in the middle of the trail, pointing down the trail towards us, but there's nobody around."
Mm-hmm.
And I'm, ooh. So I get the company commander, and I hear, "Listen." And he's going, "Okay, well, what do you see? You know, what's around?" And I said, "Oh, there's nobody around." "Oh, wait. And all of a sudden, you hear the M16s light up.
Mm-hmm.
And then the AKs fire up, and then all of a sudden, everything's breaking loose.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what had happened is we had walked into a small bunker complex, and they had set up, the enemy had set up a machine gun in the middle of the trail, pointing down the trail towards where we were coming. And there was nobody there.
Mm-hmm.
What had happened is the two guys that were supposed to be manning the machine gun had walked back in to the bunker complex to get something to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And were walking back up the trail
right.
towards the machine gun. And our point man saw them coming up the trail and opened up on them.
Uh-huh.
They
right.
never got their AKs off their shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
He caught them in the wide open. And then there were a bunch of other North Vietnamese, they were actually North Vietnamese,
mm-hmm.
that were around that same bunker complex that opened up on us. Well, it turns out that there was a sniper that was on the other side of the, and would have been across from where the machine gun was. And he saw us, spotted us then when we opened up. And he sat up in this tree taking pot shots. And he got one of our guys.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about the time that we turned around, and you know, I turned around the battalion radio operator and said, "We need air support now." So he called in, originally called in Cobras, and they came in, and we still hadn't broke contact. They got there real quick. They got there within 3 minutes, 3 to 4 minutes. They bounced them right away. They got out there, opened up, but still wasn't breaking contact. So he got back on the radio again and said, "Okay, we're still in contact. We need jets."
Mm-hmm.
So they brought out some jets that had 250-pound bombs, and they brought out a couple of jets that had napalm.
Mm-hmm.
They dropped a couple of bombs in, still had contact, and they came in and did one strafe with napalm and broke contact immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And so we wound up, two guys got wounded, one guy got killed on our side. We found probably half a dozen blood trails, and we know we got two for sure. And then we found, we termed it a crispy critter. We found one that napalm got.
Mm-hmm.
So we definitely had three kills. I think they gave us a total of about 10 kills out of it based off the blood trails.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the first true, honest-to-God firefight. And I think the thing that sticks in my mind the very most about that was I was on the company radio and was calling in the helicopters after the firefight, and we had gotten to a spot where they could land some helicopters, and they had brought the body of the soldier that got killed in our side. They brought him in along with the guy that was going back for the one of the guys that got wounded, and they had him wrapped in a poncho liner with a couple of bamboo poles on each side to carry him. And when the helicopter was coming in, there was only me and two other people standing there. And the two guys couldn't pick him up on their own to get him on the helicopter. So I had to go over, put the radio down, and I had to help him load him on the helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
And that sticks in my mind. That was a bad day, very bad day.
Sure, yes, sir.
And anyway, when I got done, I came back and sat down, and the helicopter pilot called back on the radio and said, "Yeah, it doesn't look like you guys had a very good day today." No, but it wasn't a good day.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. From what you could tell, about what size enemy unit, about how big was the enemy unit you'd run into?
Typically, the groups that we ran into were keeping in mind we were working what was called the Sturgis Jungle Trail, which is part of the main supply routes, the part of the main Ho Chi Minh Trail that came down as it crossed in from Cambodia in the Fish Hook region.
Okay.
And what we typically ran into were groups of people within the supply groups that were running supplies up and down the trail. They weren't large units. I'm going to say on an average, we ran into groups of between 3 and 10 individuals. Most of what we would find after the firefight was supplies, animal supplies, bicycles, rice, just any kind of typical supply that you could think of that they would need. So I'm sure what we were primarily running into were small supply units. Never any large units. If we saw, we heard them. We knew they were there, but we never actually physically got into contact with them. We tried desperately to avoid those kinds of contacts. When we, and I'm sure we'll get into this later, but when we went into Cambodia, we were originally set up 500 meters from the Cambodian border on an LZ 2 days before we were going to go in. We knew we were going in.
Right.
We knew we were going in. And we set up on this LZ, and we were building the LZ. So it was brand new, made a lot of noise, a lot of helicopters coming and going. Not a real good time to be there, but, you know, that's what we were doing. And at night, we could sit on this, we were on a hill, we could sit on this rise and see lights across the border and hear the trucks.
Oh, wow. Right.
So, you know, they were moving stuff out. They were trying to get as much out as they could get out because they knew we were coming too. But there was a lot of noise and a lot of racket. And that's what we were trying to avoid, but yet we knew that's where we were going. So most of the units we dealt with initially were small units, very small units. And that's the whole time I was there, that's what we dealt with. A lot of AK fire, some RPG rounds, but not anything major, not day-long battles or anything like that. Most of the firefights we were in lasted maybe 5 minutes, maybe 10, maybe 15 minutes at the very most.
Right, yes, sir. All right. Well, I hate to stop you here, but my boss just knocked on the door and told me that he's got an interview in about five minutes.
My voice is going to come out.
Sure. This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, continuing an oral history interview with Mr. Gordon Swenson. Today is February 5th, 2010. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library on the campus of Texas Tech, and Mr. Swenson is joining me by phone from California once again. Okay, last time when we left off, we were just talking about your battalion's first real firefight with the enemy. And today I was wondering if we could talk a bit in more general terms to begin with about the North Vietnamese and your impressions of them.
Okay, primarily when I was there and the group I was with, we didn't see any of the quote-unquote Viet Cong. All of our firefights and battles that were fought were with the North Vietnamese Army.
Okay.
And they were very, I won't use the term aggressive, but they were very, very persistent. They were trained fairly well, at least the individuals that we came up against. They were fairly aggressive. They had a tendency to do more guerrilla tactics. The groups that we fought were smaller groups. We'd go into contact usually 3, maybe up to 10 individuals. No large size groups, but lots of small size groups. Most of the groups that we would go up against were primarily the resupply groups, the people that were carrying the supplies up and down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Out of Cambodia and into Vietnam. And we'd hit elements of them. Supply groups that consisted of primarily carriers, people that would load up the bicycles and push the bicycles up and down the trails, and cooks, and just broken up groups of people, not large, what we consider a regular army type group, but groups of individuals. They were all well uniformed. They all had their helmets and rifles and the typical NVA garb, and they were generally fairly clean, not ragtag, not torn. The clothing was fairly clean, and they were primarily well shaven, fresh haircuts. So they were a fairly organized group, but it was small bands, is what we saw. They, again, to reiterate, they were fairly persistent. They seemed to be fairly well trained, and didn't give in easy. We did have a few situations where we would get into contacts, or we'd be ready to make in to move aggressively towards the enemy. They would get word of this or see that we were moving into the area, and we would on occasion have them come in and surrender. But for the most part, they were out in the jungle and stayed fairly well hidden, and I'm sure there were a lot of times they saw us and we never saw them, and they just wanted to avoid contact because it was such a small group, and we were a company of roughly 100, 110 people. So they were kind of doing the same thing we were doing. They were just walking around trying to stay out of contact, but if we did see each other, then we opened up.
Okay. All right. You mentioned them being fairly well hidden. Were they using things like tunnels, or what sort of camouflage and things would they use to conceal themselves?
The areas that we were in were relatively thick jungle. There were a number of small bunkers. Occasionally we'd come into a bunker complex that would have 8 to 10 of these bunkers dug out, which could easily conceal up to 10 people in each bunker. They each had openings in the front where they could conceal a machine gun or a rifle. That was a fairly common tactic. Didn't see a lot of tunnels. That wasn't a common thing where we were. In fact, I can't specifically remember ever seeing what I would call a tunnel complex. A lot of bunkers. Saw those on a very regular basis. Concealed bunker type situations. When we got into Cambodia, I don't want to go too far ahead, but when we got into Cambodia, things changed pretty dramatically at that point. We were finding very, very large bunker complexes and much more storage areas, large covered areas where rice could be stored or whatever the supplies were. We found one ammo cache that was a 3-layer deep, huge, huge ammo stash. And so they were excellent at camouflage and excellent at digging. Even though, again, we didn't see a lot of tunnels, I think that had to do with the clay that we were in. Would have collapsed fairly easy, but bunkers were pretty easy to dig out, and that seemed to be their common way of doing things.
Okay. All right. Getting back to that that first firefight for just a second, what was the timeline on that? When did that one occur? Do you know?
It would have been in February. In February of 1970.
Okay. All right. Okay. Well, in contrast to the North Vietnamese, I know you mentioned working with Kit Carson scouts, but did you ever work with any ARVN units?
No. Like I said, we got in our first firefight with them. But
right.
That was actually popular for us. But, we didn't see where we were. I always use the terminology. You hear all the stories about going into the Saigon and going into the large cities and stuff. the whole time I was there, the only thing I would even remotely come close to saying that was a city was actually a large army base called Song Bay.
Okay.
And we were riding on tracks, and we had an opportunity to go through a village. And we were so used to being out in the jungles and being in pre-fire zones that it was a complete culture shock for us to be in that environment where we saw people and we didn't shoot.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very, very different environment that we were in most of the time. And again, we didn't see popular forces or Viet Cong at all.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the anything we ever saw was North Vietnamese, and if we were on a large support base like Quan Loi or Song Bay, we would see civilians.
Okay.
That would come in and out of the wire. But as far as the Arvins, we weren't around them. Never saw them.
Okay. All right. well, it's getting back to the timeline. As far as the narrative of the events that you experienced in Vietnam, following that that first firefight in February, were there other significant ones that stick out in your mind prior to the Cambodian invasion that you could talk about?
Well, we had a few that were in between the February first fight and then the May start of the influx into Cambodia. We had a few little skirmishes. Most of those at that time, I was already in the main CP and working as a radio operator.
Okay.
So I wasn't directly out in at the front with the platoons that were getting in the firefights. However, we were close. I mean, we were to the point to where we would, you know, when we dropped the bombs, we'd better be laying on the ground. But that was my primary function at that point, was to call in the gunships and the bombers and direct them and get them coordinated into the areas that we needed the fire support put on.
Mm-hmm.
I also worked for a short amount of time as an artillery operator, artillery radio operator, which was pretty interesting considering I had no artillery background whatsoever, and I'm calling in artillery. So that got a little spooky, but fortunately I had a forward officer that was an artillery officer who primarily would tell me what to say, or he would take the radio and do all the communicating, and I was just there to listen if somebody happened to call. But I got to do that a little bit, did learn a little bit about how to do it before I progressed up and went into doing the actual company RTO job. We did have one situation. We were on a fire support base. We called them LZs, or landing zones,
mm-hmm.
which is basically one company comes in and does the guard for the fire support base. And the fire support base is where they bring in all the artillery. That's where the artillery is set.
Mm-hmm.
And the mortars are there, and then they can shoot out from those locations to protect all of the units that are out in the field. And we were on one of these LZs. Typically, we would be there for maybe a week. And then what we would do is pull guard duty at night, and then during the day you just kind of hung around. You'd go out and add more concertina, or do, you know, set up your security around the fire support base. But we were on the LZ. It was April Fool's. It was April 1st, about 2 in the morning. And I was asleep down in the bunker. Talked to people after it happened, and they all had made indication that they heard about 4 or 5 pops from outside the wire, and it was just pop, pop, pop. And the guys that were out pulling guard duty that night all had a pretty good idea what it was. They couldn't see it, but they could hear it. And then after about 15, 20, 30 seconds, the first one came in. And what had happened is outside the wire somewhere, somebody had set up, one of the NVA teams had set up a mortar, 122-millimeter mortar,
okay.
and popped in about 5 or 8 rounds. And when they set the rounds to go off, you can determine the depth that you want the round to go before it ignites. and they set them all to go off deep. We determined this after the fact. And what they were trying to do is for the 105 howitzers on the fire support base at night, they use a small red light as an aiming light around each one of the guns.
Okay.
And they could see those lights, and they knew where our main command post was on the fire support base. And as they went back and reviewed it later, they could see where the first round hit, second round hit, third round hit. They were trying to get those rounds to go into the fire support base, or into the TOC, the main headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, none of them hit it. They got close, but none of them hit it. The first round landed pretty close to the wire. The second round landed almost on top of one of our bunkers that was inside the complex, and it killed one of our guys, an M60 gunner, and wounded our Kit Carson scout. And the next round landed a little bit closer. One of the rounds landed just outside the bunker I was in and landed in the mound of dirt that they had, when we dug the bunker out, we piled the dirt next to it, and it landed in the middle of that dirt. And when it exploded, all the dirt flew out side to side. The guy that was out on radio watch that night had covered him in the dirt, and he was okay. It didn't hurt him, but
right.
Fortunately, since all the rounds went deep and they didn't really penetrate any bunkers, we only had the one fatality, and that was just extremely lucky, because if they would have had those rounds go off above ground, it would have killed anybody that was outside the bunkers.
Right.
And would have taken out a number of people.
Yeah.
We had a kind of an unusual situation. They had taken a minigun, which is normally mounted on the helicopters, and it's a six-barreled machine gun that rotates, and when it fires, it looks like the old-fashioned Gatling gun, but when it fires, it doesn't go bang, 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 bang. It makes a sound that kind of goes womp, and that's kind of what it sounds like. It's shooting that fast. It's a solid stream of red, and the way they load the gun is every sixth round is a tracer round, and that solid stream of red, you're seeing six rounds in between each
right.
red round. So it's putting out a high volume of fire. We had one of those on the LZ, not on a helicopter. They brought it out and set it up on the LZ without any helicopter around.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is, because they put up such a rapid rate of fire, they get very, very hot. So when they came out and trained the sergeant to show him how to fire it, they told him, short rounds, short blasts of rounds. Don't fire it any more than maybe 3 to 5 seconds, and then you have to stop and let it cool down, or you'll melt the barrels.
Uh-huh.
Well, when the first round started coming in, he woke up, came out, figured we were going to get overrun, so went out and grabbed the minigun, opened up with it, and just held the button down on the minigun.
Mm.
And he melted the barrels down on the minigun.
So
it was a very scary night. It we figured we were probably going to get hit. We didn't.
Right.
But turned out later, when they went back and reevaluated it, they were trying to hit the main headquarters for that LZ, and they just missed it.
Right.
But we had a few other skirmishes after that, the conventional 10 to 15 minute max, usually 3 to 5 minute firefight, where there'd be maybe 100 rounds total shot off. We'd call in gunships or helicopters, bombers, whatever we could, to try to break that contact. Our objective at that point was go out, find them, make contact, and then bring in everything we had to try to break that contact as soon as we could.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the game plan was they were trying to keep the activity level up but not get anything too major, because they knew we were eventually going to get put into Cambodia. They wanted the resources to be ready to do that.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's kind of what the Army at that point was thinking.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, before getting into Cambodia, you mentioned being that artillery radio operator for a moment. How did you get into that position?
Well, it was one of those unusual things where you kind of work yourself up through the chain as you're trying trying to advance.
Uh-huh.
And I had been a platoon radio operator for a relatively short amount of time.
Uh-huh.
And they were, I had a really close friend that was a company radio at that point, and he had been conversing with the captain and telling him, you know, hey, we've got a guy here that's pretty good. And I had talked to the commanding officer on the radio a few times, so he knew I had the ability to do that. We'd been in a couple of different small skirmishes, so he knew that how I would handle those situations on a radio, had a pretty good idea what I would do in those situations. So they were looking to put me in a position to get me into the main CP of the group.
Okay.
And we had a situation where we had a radio operator that was working the artillery radios that was good, and they put him into the main TOC headquarters on the fire support base.
Mm-hmm.
They moved him into a position to do that, to handle the fire support from that main central location where all the guns were, which left the position open for the field radio or artillery operator.
Okay.
And so they decided, well, let's put him in that slot. We'll get him in here until we can bring somebody in that's actually an artillery guy and put him on the radio.
Right.
So it was kind of a temporary position to get me into a slot to hopefully make advances further along, which I eventually did.
Uh-huh.
But I flat out told them when they said, you know, we want to make you the artillery operator, I told them, don't know anything about artillery, you know?
Right.
So whatever it is, it's going to be brand new to me. But I was very fortunate in the officer, the lieutenant that was the artillery officer out in the field for us, had a lot of patience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he trained me, he showed me a lot of things, and to this day he's probably the only reason I can still sit and look at a military map and be able to read it, because he taught me how to read military maps really well.
Right. All right. Well, how long did you operate in that position?
It was probably about a month.
Okay.
At the very most.
Mm-hmm.
And they eventually brought another radio operator out, and very shortly after that, Lieutenant Griffith was the radio or the field artillery officer that I worked with. He went to the rear to work the artillery on the fire support base, and when they did that, they put in a higher ranking radio operator who knew artillery and a new forward observer officer that to work as a team. And then at that point, the position was open to take the company radio over, so I wound up taking that radio over.
All right. Well, is there anything else we should mention before getting into the Cambodian campaign?
Just a little bit about what the climate was like at that point.
Okay.
We were still working in the dry season. Water in smaller creeks was at a premium. There was generally water available in creeks all over, everywhere we went. You could walk for a half a day and you'd come across two or three small streams that were potable water. It was water that you could actually fill canteens if you needed to. Water was one of those things that you just didn't run out of. You couldn't. It was so hot and humid that was one thing you never wanted to run out of.
Right.
As a radio operator, they told me before I took the radio, they said, you know, it's miserable carrying that big old heavy radio. It's 25-pound radio and another 5-pound battery, and you got 7 days of food, and you're carrying, you know, if you're carrying a radio, you got to carry at least 8 quarts of water.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get all that on a backpack, and it gets pretty heavy. So as the time progressed and the water was getting drier and drier in the creeks, there were a few days where we ran short. And I can remember a few times when we couldn't land a helicopter. There was no way we got our resupply, or what we called our log day. we couldn't land a helicopter to unload the supplies. So what they would have to do is fly the helicopter over a kind of open spot and do what we call a kickout.
Mm-hmm.
And a kickout, they basically kicked the sea rations out of the side of the helicopter and they fell to the ground. And in order to get water to us, they couldn't land a blivet or anything that we could get the water out of. So what they do is they take empty 155 howitzer canisters that they put the artillery rounds in, fill those full of water, and then kick those out because they're a big metal container that wouldn't break open when it hit the ground.
Right.
And all I can remember is there were a lot of times I would have preferred to go thirsty over drinking the water that came out of those. It was really bad.
Right.
Really bad. And there were a few times when we would get to a creek where you'd have to dig a small little opening in the creek to get the water deep enough to put the canteen in to fill half the canteen.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd have to sit there and wait for 10 minutes to let enough water flow past to clear the silt out to be able to put the canteen in to get the water. And that was still better than what came out of those 155 canisters. But water was at that point getting to be a little bit of a premium. Just about the time we were getting ready to go into Cambodia, the weather was beginning to change. We were starting to get into the monsoon season, which the monsoon season, it would start out by raining maybe 5 minutes in the morning.
Okay.
And then it would be dry the rest of the day. The next day, it would rain 10 minutes in the morning, and it'd be dry the rest of the day. The next day, it would rain 15 minutes in the morning, and then maybe 5 minutes in the afternoon, and then it would be dry the rest of the day. And it progressed like that to the point where it was eventually going to rain, we thought, 24 hours a day. And monsoon rains are one of those things occasionally in the United States, you'll get a very, very, very heavy rainstorm. And that was your typical monsoon.
Mm-hmm.
And it would do that for, like I say, a period of time in the morning and then a period of time in the afternoon. And it would rain that hard. And it was so predictable that we could, if we knew we weren't going to be on the LZ for a period of time, and it was starting to get where we were out for 10 or 15 days, we all were getting kind of rank. So what we would do would be take a bar of soap. You knew when it was going to start raining, pretty close, and you'd strip down and get ready, and when it would rain, you'd soap up, and you knew how long it was going to rain, and you knew how much time you had. You could actually rinse off, time it so that you could get soaked up and rinsed off and take a shower in the monsoon.
Right.
And that everybody used to do that on a pretty regular basis.
Right. All right. Well, as the Army was getting ready to go into Cambodia, did your unit know anything about the preparations and the plans and the fact that you were actually going to do this? Or I guess at what point did you know?
We had always worked fairly close to the Cambodian border within, well, Quan Loi was, if I remember correctly, about 7 or 8 miles from the Cambodian border. We were always working between Quan Loi and the Cambodian border, so we were always fairly close to it. But we had gotten, there had been some rumblings, just, you know, the normal conversations at night. People would say, you know, we're getting awful close to the border, you know. I think, you know, they're talking about we might go in. And then we got notification that they were going to fly us out to a new area to build a new LZ that was 500 meters from the Cambodian border. We'd never been that close before. And so we got notified to go out there. We started the construction on it. We knew we were close to the border. We knew we were right in the line of path of where all the supplies were getting ferried in. We were in what was called the fish hook. We were right in the middle of it. And we could hear the trucks across the border at night moving. Couldn't see any headlights, but we could hear them. So we knew there was a lot of activity going on across the border, and that's when things came down and said, get ready, guys, we're going in. We're going to go across the border, and we're going to go in. We're going to go after the supply groups. And so everybody was pretty apprehensive. It wasn't official yet, but we knew it was going to happen. And then the day before the official invasion, the notice came down, get ready, they're taking them in.
Uh-huh.
Now, it turned out our unit was pulling duty on the LZ for that 4 or 5 days. And other companies went into Cambodia officially. Uh-huh. And so they were over in Cambodia, and we were still on the LZ.
Yeah.
And so being a radio operator, I could listen and hear all the things that were going on. And I started hearing about the other units finding these large cache of weapons, and they're getting into a few of them getting into small skirmishes, nothing big. They'd fire off artillery into the areas that they were going into. We were doing a lot of that. But for the first 3 days, I think it was 3 days, we weren't in Cambodia. We didn't go in first. Our particular company was about 3 days later, and then they rotated out one of the other companies to the LZ, and they took us and put us back in. And I can vividly remember the first day going into Cambodia for me personally.
Okay.
Cambodia was like a whole different world compared to Vietnam. We weren't that far away. We were within, I'm going to say, probably within 2 miles of the LZ from the Vietnam side of the border to the Cambodian side of the border.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other side of the border, it was completely different. The way I always turn, everything was bigger.
Okay.
Significantly bigger. The centipedes were bigger. The lizards were bigger. The trails were bigger. The buildings, the huts, the bunkers, everything we saw was larger, on a much larger scale.
Right.
And it's because it was untouched.
Uh-huh.
Vietnam side, everything had probably either gotten killed off or was made smaller because people weren't able to stay in one location for any. The North Vietnamese couldn't stay in one location for a long period of time. They had to be moving.
Uh-huh.
So they'd build a bunker to tide them over for a day or two and then move on. In Cambodia, they'd build the bunkers huge so they could put supplies and whatever, and they could stay there for 2 months.
Uh-huh.
And nobody'd ever mess with them. So with all of those things combined, it was one of those unique situations, like it was going into a whole different world going over into Cambodia. Mm. Bunker complexes over there were huge. I mean, 100, 150 bunkers in the complex. And we'd maybe see 10 in Vietnam at the most.
Mm-hmm.
And it was because of the fact it was a supply route. That's where the troops freshened up. They'd go back across the border. That was their R&R spot. I mean, they could go over there and not worry about being harassed by U.S. troops looking for them.
Right.
We had one situation, I think it was about the second or third night we were in Cambodia. We had been walking all day, and we already found one small arms cache, but you know, no big deal. That night, we went in to set up our perimeter, and they went out and put all the trip flares out, went out and put the claymores out. We're all sitting there, and all of a sudden somebody called in on the radio and said, I think we found a bunker. So I'm figuring it's one of the guys out putting the claymores. I said, okay, well, where is it? He says, in the very middle of the perimeter.
Huh, wow.
And we said, okay, is there anybody there? And they said, no, it's just a big bunker. And so we said, okay, well, you know, look in it, see what you can see. And he came back a little bit later, and he says, it's full of weapons. And I said, okay, well, it's getting too dark. We don't want to mess with it tonight. As long as there's nobody in it, leave it, and we'll tear into it tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
So the next morning, everybody got up, and they started tearing this bunker apart. And the bunker size was about 50 feet wide and about 100 feet long.
Oh, wow.
And about 8 feet deep, so we thought. So they started hauling out weapons, and they got that done, and as they're finishing off tearing out the first group of weapons, or getting those weapons out of the bunker, one of the guys says, "I just stepped through the floor."
Huh.
And so come to find out that there was a bamboo floor, subfloor. So they opened that up, and here's another whole story to this bunker. And it's full of weapons.
Mm-hmm.
So they start backhauling that. So at this point, we decide, well, we better, you know, this is going to take a while to get this stuff out of here, because we'd gotten a call from battalion, and they said, everything gets backhauled. You're taking everything out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh, great, you know. So now we find out there's two levels to this thing, so we're going to be there a few days. And this isn't good, because we're going to be in one spot for 2 days with
right.
helicopters flying in and out. So they know we're there.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there's no way to hide that. They know we're there.
Right.
And we'd been mortared earlier back in April, so we're all thinking, man, they could just sit here and pump mortars in, and they're going to get everybody. Because
mm-hmm.
we didn't have any formal bunkers to secure the area with. Mm-hmm. We were doing this like we'd normally set up a perimeter at night.
Right.
So anyway, they get about half of the second floor done, and they suddenly realize that they're still walking on bamboo. Turns out they pop through that bamboo, and there's a third floor to it.
Wow.
So this thing's 3 stories deep, 100 feet long and 50 feet wide, and
wow.
it's full of every kind of weapon you can think of. We found Russian anti-aircraft machine guns. We found probably 20 of those. We found bazookas. We found every kind of Russian rifle and Chinese rifle you can think of.
Mm-hmm.
Brand new, fresh, greased up, all wrapped up, ready to go. Found a number of M16s, American rifles,
mm-hmm.
and with serial numbers on them. Those all got backhauled to figure out, you know, where they came from, because they couldn't figure that out.
Right.
The bottom of the bunker was filled with munitions.
Huh.
All different kinds of rounds and things.
Right.
Well, by this time, obviously, battalions, wow, this is great. We got all kinds of VIPs coming out, and everybody wants to take a look. They sent out photography guys, and so everybody's getting kind of antsy, because we've been there for about 4 days.
Right.
This isn't good. We've been there way too long, and we knew that they had to be watching us. They had to know what we were doing, and we just knew we were going to get hit. We were waiting for something to happen. So we were there the last day, and the commanding officer got with me and said, call battalion and make sure, tell them that, don't ask them, tell them we're going to blow the munitions.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to blow them up. So I called back and I said, we're going to blow the munitions out here. Within 5 minutes, I got a call back and said, don't blow it, we want it backhauled.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man. So for about a half a day, we took about half of the munitions out of the bunker. And, I mean, everybody's dead tired.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, the CO comes over and says, all right, go in and take the rest of the munitions, pile C4 on top of it, and we're going to blow it. And he said, but don't tell battalion we're doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Wait until I tell you, and then what we're going to do is we're going to have a bunch of artillery called in. Close to this area,
uh-huh.
and then we're going to blow the munitions. And if anybody asks, gee, that artillery must have got a great secondary, which means the artillery hit something.
Right.
So that's what we wound up doing, and we walked about 5 kilometers away from the bunker before we blew it, and we were all, they did a countdown, and everybody got ready, and they blew the bunker, and I can remember pieces of shrapnel falling down out of the sky from the rounds that we'd blown up.
Mm-hmm.
We found an awful lot of stuff when we were in that first group.
Huh.
About 3 or 4 days later, we were out still walking around in the jungle and came across a 2-story thatched roof storage area with 500 tons of rice.
Mm-hmm.
We wound up backhauling 500 tons of rice.
Wow.
And that took us 3 or 4 days. We found 23 bicycles.
Uh-huh.
guys up and down. These were brand new bicycles, so they'd obviously brought the bikes down to use them to get the stuff into Vietnam, but hadn't gotten them out yet. These are all things we found.
Right.
There were tons and tons of tractor tire, truck tire trails.
Okay.
And you could see empty bunkers that they were able to get the supplies out of and get them out of there before we got there. So there was a, we made a major dent when we did that, a major dent in the supply line when we did that. And that's probably the only thing that kept South Vietnam going for any length of time, was the fact that we went and did the incursion and got all of those supplies out of there. Didn't get into any major firefights. Got into a couple little ones, but it was usually just remnants, you know, one or two people that wound up not getting out of there. And just real quick, in and out, break contact and get away. So it wasn't anything major. One of the days, it would have been June 3rd, as it had rained that morning, and I can remember we were all sitting along the perimeter, and I heard somebody walk up behind me, and I turned around, and about the time I turned around, I realized it was one of our guys taking a picture. And I just kind of turned around, and then I waved and smiled and waved, and he wandered back off, never paid any more attention to it. Later that day, we were walking down a trail, and we're still in kind of mountainous areas, and the, let's see, it would have been the executive officer was in front of me, or was the second person in front of me. Commanding officer was directly in front of me, and then it was me carrying the radio, battalion radio. And we got to the top of this hill. The executive officer took a couple steps out. His feet came out from underneath him, and he slid to the bottom of the hill. Now, this is a real red, slippery, slippery clay. So he's standing up there laughing because he watched him slide to the bottom. It was like a giant water slide.
Right.
Then the commanding officer took a couple steps. His feet came out from under him. He slid to the bottom of the hill. So I'm up there and standing there laughing because it's kind of funny to watch two officers sliding to the bottom of the hill.
Right.
So I took a couple of steps forward, and about that time my feet came out. And as I came, as I landed on my back, my arms went up.
Okay.
And I slid to the bottom of the hill, and I, when I got to the bottom of the hill, I'm sitting there and I'm laughing because I'm laying on the ground all covered with mud. And I went to turn to push myself up and realized that something was wrong because I couldn't push. And so about that time I lifted my left arm up and realized that I had caught my wrist on an open piece of bamboo. The bamboo, when it dries, it splits open.
Okay.
And it had broken in half, and I'd caught my wrist on the edge of that bamboo and sliced my wrist all the way across.
Oh, wow.
And so blood's gushing out everywhere, and I'm sitting there going, uh-oh. And the executive officer saw what had happened, and so he yelled up and said, get a medic. And so the medic slid down the hill to get to me, and as he's sitting there at the bottom of the hill, he's going, okay, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, you know, I don't know at this point. What do I need to do? He says, well, do I need to give you morphine? I said, no, it doesn't hurt that bad. And the executive officer's going, yeah, but it looks bad. Now, you could actually see tendons sticking out of the wrist, so it's fairly bad.
Right.
But I'm going, well, it doesn't hurt, so it couldn't be that bad. And so the medic says, well, call in a medic, you know, we need to get a medic back bird out of here, we're going to have to fly you out. I'm okay, so I grabbed my radio and I called in for a medevac bird. And about two or three days before that, we had been set up the perimeter that night, and we were on a secure radio system, which was a way we could connect the radios and talk open. We didn't have to worry about using codes and stuff. And I'm talking to the guy back at the main headquarters back on the fire base, and he's telling me, get ready because they're getting ready to pull you out of the field to bring you in and let you work and talk.
Right.
And I thought, that's great. You know, I'm going to get out of the field. And he said, so, you know, be ready because it could happen any day. Well, as I'm calling in for my medevac bird, the guy I'm talking to is the same guy. And so when I called in, I said, okay, I need a medevac bird at the following location, and I gave him the grid coordinates and everything. And he says, okay, well, who's it for? And I go, Sierra 0911, which was me.
Uh-huh.
And he goes, okay. Then he comes back and he says, could you repeat who this is for? And I said, it's for me.
Uh-huh.
And he goes, oh, no. And I said, yeah, I fell down the hill and they got to medevac me out. And so, anyway, by this time, they're trying to get the radio away from me because they're trying to get ready to fly me out.
Right.
And I could start to hear the helicopter coming. That's one thing I will have to say. I have to stop for a second and mention this. We had fantastic air support.
Okay.
Our medevac birds, our gunships, the bombers, the guys that flew in for us, I can't say enough. They were there unbelievably quickly. They would do anything we wanted. If we asked for them to do something special, it was never a question of why or when. It was okay, we'll do it. We had forward observer spotter aircraft that would actually fly over, and they knew we were there, and they'd call down and see if we needed anything. And there were a couple of times we could get lost fairly easy because of where we were. There were a few times that they would have to spot us,
Okay. Actually
figure out where we were, and then they could call down and give us secure coordinates so we'd know where we were.
Right.
The pilots were unbelievable. It was just an amazing thing. Well, anyway, I'm sitting on the ground. Medevac bird's coming in. He's calling in, making sure where we are, and he calls in and he says, okay, we need to bring you up. Do you want a rigid litter or a jungle penetrator? And I'm sitting there, and I'm now starting to feel a little woozy. I'm holding my arm up over my head, and I'm going, there's no way I can put my arm inside a rigid litter. That isn't going to work. I've got to go up on a JP, which is a jungle penetrator. It's kind of a T-squared device that you sit on.
Okay.
And so I turned to the medic and I said, you think I'm going to pass out? And he says, I don't think so, but I don't know. And I said, well, I guess I won't then.
Mm-hmm.
So they, from about 50 feet, 60 feet up, they dropped the JP down. They took all of my equipment off me and they started to take my M16 away, and I said, no, I'm taking that with me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took that, my steel pot, but everything else came off on my back, and they JP'd me up into the helicopter and then flew me out from there. I wound up going to the hospital in Benoit the first night. Went to an aid station in Quan Loi first. The aid station in Quan Loi, when they flew in on the helicopter, the old TV show MASH at the very beginning when they fly you in, that had to be Quan Loi. It looked exactly the same from the air. It looked exactly like that. When I got off the helicopter, they took me into the aid station. And he took off the Band-Aid, or the field dressing, took that off, took one look at it, and said, well, we got to send you in Benoit. There's nothing we can do for you here. So they put it back on, and I'm sitting there at the aid station waiting for the next helicopter to come in to take me to Benoit, and all of a sudden, here comes a guy walking in the door from my company with a field dressing on his hand, on the left hand. I'm going, what happened? He said, I fell down on the same piece of bamboo.
Huh. Wow.
So they moved the bamboo after that, so he told me. They weren't going to let anybody else get hurt with it.
Right.
But then the helicopter came in, flew me into Benoit, and I was in the hospital there. All they could do there was stitch up the external portion. They couldn't do repair any tendons. So they stitched up the external portion. Well, in the meantime, through my feeble mind, and having been the guy that used to say I'm too smart for this, I won't ever have to go out in the field, I'm thinking, well, you know, they'll just sew me up. I'll be back out in the field in a couple of days. The doctor came in that night, and he says, I got two things to tell you. He said, number one, you're in big trouble. And I said, what's that? And he goes, they forgot to take the SOIs out of your pocket. Now, the SOIs are the secure codes for the radio.
Okay.
And they are, at that point, were extremely confidential. and I didn't think to take them out of my pocket. Nobody else remembered to tell me to take them out of my pocket, so I brought them with me.
Uh-huh.
And nobody in the field had the secure information anymore to operate the radio.
Oh, wow.
So it was kind of a big deal. But
right.
So they had locked them up in the commanding officer's safe at the hospital, and I had to go down there and get them out of the safe so they could take them back out to the field to the guys in the field.
Uh-huh.
But he said, and the other thing is, you're going home. And I said, what do you mean going home? You're going home. We're going to fly you to Japan. They're going to fix you. They're going to fix your hand. And then we're going to fly you home.
Mm-hmm.
He said, because you're not going to have use of your left arm for probably 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going, you're kidding. And he goes, no, you're going home. So anyway, a couple of days there, they flew me up to Saigon, put me on a big jet, flew me to Japan. I was in Japan for 2 months. And I would say over my entire span of being in Vietnam, being in the field, seeing combat, the worst I ever saw was when I was in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I saw the damage.
Right.
I saw everything you can possibly imagine that could happen to a human being and still have them be alive.
Mm-hmm.
I got to see that when I was in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
It was terrible. I can't believe the destruction. Being ambulatory and being one of the people who could actually walk and do things within the hospital, I was one of those lucky few that got to hold people down when they changed the bandages and the dressings and the people that lost legs and arms.
Oh, yes, sir.
Just people waking up in the middle of the night screaming in pain. It was a very traumatic time.
Mm-hmm.
We had the ward that I was in. We had three guys that were in complete full traction, complete body cast from their neck to their toes. And Japan was usually cloudy, overcast most of the time. One day it was clear, and we were all sitting there, and these guys had been there for like 4 or 5 weeks, and were just going stir crazy because they couldn't move. I mean, they're in full traction. They couldn't do anything.
Right.
And so, since the sun was shining, we're all kind of looking. You know those two great big doors down there at the end? I bet we could roll those beds outside. Yeah, we could do that. So we opened up the doors, went and got the beds, wheeled them out. In the meantime, the nurses saw what we were doing, thought, hey, that's kind of a cool idea. So anyway, we rolled them out on the front lawn in front of the hospital ward. This is at Camp Drake.
Okay.
And we're out on this front lawn, and it just so happened that there was a war protest going on that day.
Huh.
And we're on one side of the fence, and the protesters are on the other side of the fence.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some things said to us, and we said some things back, and the next thing you know, they start heaving rocks over the fence.
Oh, man.
And they almost hit one of the guys that was in the bed. So the MPs show up. They get them ran off. And we had to roll all the beds back in. Beautiful sunny day, first time we'd ever done it.
Right.
We now had to roll all the beds back into the hospital. So
that
wasn't too much fun. But
uh-huh.
Anyway, from there, they flew me back to Fort Ord. Wound up at Fort Ord in the hospital system there for a few more months until I got enough use in my left hand that they decided to fly me to Fort Hood, Texas. Wound up at Fort Hood and wound up doing the rest of my service with the Army at Fort Hood, Texas,
mm-hmm.
where they made me a company clerk.
Right. Right. All right. Well, we're unfortunately running out of time for today, but I would like to ask some follow-up questions to some of the things you talked about with Cambodia, your injuries, and your time in the hospital and coming home. But unfortunately, run out of time for today. This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, continuing an oral history interview with Mr. Gordon Swenson. Today is March 1st, 2010. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library on the campus of Texas Tech, and Mr. Swenson is joining me by phone once again from California. Okay, as I just mentioned, last time we were talking about your experiences during the Cambodian incursion and your subsequent injury. I'd like to ask a few follow-up questions related to that. First of all, looking at that time period when you guys had heard the news that you were going to be going into Cambodia, what was the feeling among the guys about going into the NVA sanctuary? Because I know for much of the entire period of the war up to that point, it had been off limits, but the NVA had always been using it as a sanctuary. So what was the general feeling among the guys about finally hitting the NVA in that sanctuary?
Well, the biggest concern was, again, we had mainly ran into small groups of individuals that, up 3 to 10 people at the most. And so our anticipation was that we were going to run into much larger forces once we got across the border, assuming that they would be there.
Mm-hmm.
As I'd mentioned before,
yes, sir.
Our particular company didn't go across in the original day or two after it. I think we were like the third day we finally went in.
Mm-hmm.
And I know up to and prior to the date that we were going to go across, we had been building a LZ within 500 meters of the border. So we were making a lot of racket and a lot of noise, and at night we could hear the movement of trucks and vehicles across the border, so we knew they were there.
Mm-hmm.
We just didn't know what we were going to hit when we finally went over. But as the days progressed, we heard less and less noise. And since we had a couple of companies working in the basic area that went across before we did, they had gotten into some skirmishes before we went in. And the biggest thing we kept hearing was the caches they were finding, and not so much the major troops concentrations that they were running up against. Everybody kind of moved out, and that was the feeling we were getting at any rate from the conversations we could hear on the scuttlebutt that was going on the firebase. It sounded like the majority of the troops had already left the area, and we were just coming across what they couldn't get out in time. They left pretty quickly. There were some there, and there were some minor skirmishes that took place, but it wasn't any major skirmishes that were going on. We were just finding all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, I know you talked about finding the bunkers with the huge weapon caches. How far away from the border would you estimate these bunkers actually were?
We were working anywhere from about 1 kilometer, a little less than a mile,
mm-hmm.
in from the border once we got across. So we were finding stuff within a mile of the border itself.
Wow, okay.
And obviously their intention was to get as close to the border as they could.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the borders are not a well-defined thing. In other words, there's not a street marker or anything like that identifying the exact border location.
Mm-hmm.
It's done from maps. They had pretty good maps. We had pretty good maps. So everybody kind of had a pretty good idea where that crossing actually was.
Mm-hmm.
And so they didn't get real close to it. They obviously wanted to make sure they were on their side, but they got it close enough that they didn't have to carry it that far to be into Vietnam with it.
Mm-hmm.
The surprising thing was, the entire time we were in Vietnam, we come across caches and supplies and things like that. But it was all in relatively small amounts. I mean, we'd walk into an area and we'd find maybe a ton of rice. And it, obviously that had been hauled in via bicycles or whatever in relatively small amounts in small groups just to minimize the impact of having a whole bunch of people carrying stuff back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
But in Cambodia, they were able to stockpile it. They were able to bring in, bicycle after truck after truck. We never saw them bring heavy equipment across the border. We had heard there were tanks that came across, and we'd heard that there were some vehicles, but it wasn't a common thing on the Vietnam side.
Okay.
On the Cambodian side, they used heavy equipment.
Okay.
They used major things to move supplies back and forth. once it got into those stockpiles, they could load it up on a bicycle and have a team of four or five people carry a couple bags of rice in. And when they get to a specific location, they may leave that there or go back and then get more. And so, again, on the Cambodian side, it was like walking into huge warehouses.
Yes, sir.
And on the Vietnam side, it would be like going to your local store. I mean, it was a smaller, much smaller operation on the Vietnam side.
Mm-hmm.
It was amazing. I mean, it's just stunning to walk into an area and see a huge, huge, huge building. Keep in mind, building is a whole different term there, but
right.
a covered area that was containing rice bags that stacked 30 feet high.
Oh, wow.
Right. It was just amazing. And,
mm-hmm.
and again, the arms caches were the same way. They were just absolutely huge compared to anything we'd seen before.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as personnel were concerned, we didn't see any. We had a couple of minor skirmishes, but and who knows why they were there. I think they may have just been probing to find out what we were doing, but the majority of the troops had moved out, the North Vietnamese had moved out of the area at that time. They just kind of pretty much said, okay, we're going to let them come in and do what they're going to do, and then we'll just go back and do on them later.
All right. Well, did finding these huge stockpiles of weapons and material, did that have any impact on morale among you guys?
I'm sorry, the what?
Did discovering this huge stockpile of weapons and material and rice and all these other stores, did that have any impact on the morale of you guys and your unit?
Yeah, it did. Obviously, it was very impressive to see and find all the things that we were finding, and everybody kind of got into it when we'd first find these things and get on the radio and we'd tell everybody, and it would be a big thing to the people in the rear, and it made everybody feel really good
mm-hmm.
for about the first day.
Okay.
And then the second day, reality kind of sunk in, and everybody was saying, okay, we've got to back all this stuff out of here.
Right.
And about that time, the Chinooks would start coming in and with equipment hanging slings underneath them and expect somebody had to load that stuff on those. We had to move the materials around. And we were making an awful lot of noise and doing an awful lot of work. I mean, those were very, very heavy, heavy, heavy things to pick up and move and carry. And we had to get them from wherever they were stored to the coast area that they could sling them out of, which had to be an open, a much more open area. So they'd fly in. There was a small four-wheel drive flat carrier that they called a mule. It was built similar to a Volkswagen, had a pancake motor in the back, but it was nothing more than a flat deck that one person could sit and drive on it, and then you stacked everything on the back of that mule and you could carry it around. We had a couple of those out there, and so we were using that to transport bags of rice from the location that we found it into an area that we could back haul it out of. So it was an awful lot of work. I mean, it was a lot of physical work. And the biggest concern that everybody had at that time was we were making an awful lot of noise.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And when you're out in the jungle, that's just something we never did. When we were on an LZ, it was a different thing. But an LZ, you have three or more rows of concertina wire and barbed wire, and then you had positions that were bunkered out so that you were actually inside a bunker with firing ports. It was a much more secure area, and we could make a lot of noise on there. And plus, you had artillery right there. So we could make a lot of noise on an LZ. Where we were was not that secured of an area. We had to go out at night and set up trip flares and claymores around the area that we'd be sleeping in.
Okay.
And the first 2 days that we were there, we stayed pretty much where all of that stuff was.
Mm-hmm.
And then the commanding officer made a decision that probably wasn't a good thing to do anymore. So what we would do is we'd get done at the end of the day, pack everything up on our backs, and move to get away from that general area so So if they, you know, if there were people, if the North Vietnamese were out there and they were going to pop off some mortar rounds into the area, we wouldn't be there.
Right.
So,
sir.
You know, you work a whole day in the heat and the sweating and there's no showers, so you can't take a shower. So you're physically drained at the end of the day. You got to come back and load up your pack and move a kilometer away to get away from the area. And then in the morning, you get back up and you move back in again.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an awful lot of work. The fortunate thing was we didn't get into any major combat when we were doing that. We were pretty much, they left us alone. They were pretty well gone. Like I say, I know there were some there because we saw some, but they never shot at us. We just physically saw them, and then we'd pop off around. They'd take off. We wouldn't see them again.
Mm-hmm.
So we knew they were around, but it was only one or two individuals, and we never got anything thrown in on us. We never got any mortars put in on us or anything until we left that area.
Okay.
Once we completed the task of getting the materials out of a specific cache area, we'd move on.
Mm-hmm.
And once we went in and we were looking for more caches, we'd get off in these areas and we'd go back to operating the way we always did. Everything very quiet and, you know, walking in a single line, 10 meters or so apart. And I think in a few occasions, we actually just stumbled on them.
Okay.
And in those cases, obviously a firefight would break out. But it was always, again, just like in Vietnam, it was always small groups.
Yes, sir. All right. Well, I know it was difficult to get news and hear about what was going on outside, in the outside world, when you would be out in the field in a lot of cases and other times as well. But had you guys heard anything at all about the anti-war reaction to the Cambodian invasion while you were there or any time before you were injured?
There were a few sources of information.
Okay.
Although it be delayed, we did have some information. Most everyone carried a radio, a regular transistor radio.
Okay.
I know I had one. And we get the Armed Forces radio, and obviously that's, you know, was very biased towards the information that was coming out, that was forthcoming anyway. So, but even with that, we would hear stories. We'd hear about the protests that were going on.
Okay.
But there were a few of us, myself included. One of the things that I'd done when I first got there is I wrote a letter home to my mom and asked if it would be possible if the local newspaper, the Press Enterprise in Riverside, if they could mail a newspaper to me.
Okay.
And she subscribed to that, and they did.
Oh.
So I actually got, and I think I got it, I don't know if they were sending it to me on a daily basis, because we never got anything on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
We logged, but every 4 to 7 days, so. But I do remember I would get newspapers, and sometimes it might be two or three of them. And obviously that was a regular publication in the United States, so you got the news based off how that publication was written.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, we got an opportunity to at least get some information about local stuff. It might be a week and a half old, but at least you had some idea of what was, what the world was doing. And we heard about things. We heard about the things that were going on.
Okay.
And I mean, what are you going to do?
Right.
You're there. I mean, what are you going to do? You're not going to get to come home. There's no way to get around. And everybody, at least in the unit and the group that I was with, everybody kind of had the same general feeling of, we're here, we got to do what we got to do to stay alive, and we've got to help the other guys stay alive because they're going to help us to stay alive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the way we did things. I mean, everybody was, I'm not going to say upbeat, but everybody had a pretty good comradeship amongst everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
We got along fine. There weren't any major, you had people you maybe didn't necessarily like, on a personal basis, but they were there to do the same thing you were there to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so you, and from a military standpoint, you got along with them. You know, from a personal standpoint, you may not associate with them, but from a military standpoint, you wouldn't have any issues working with them directly.
Okay.
And that seemed to be the way it was the whole time I was there anyway, for the 6 months I was there. Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir. All right. Well, asking the question about the anti-war response to Cambodia brings up, of course, another question. If you don't mind me asking, what was your take on the anti-war movement?
I think I'd mentioned in the, at the very first part of this conversation, that a couple of guys that I went into the military with or got drafted with in when we were at the reception center before we were in the basic, These are guys I'd gone to high school with.
Right.
And they deserted.
Right.
Took off. They went up to Canada. And so it was one of those things. I mean, you had to make a choice. You had to make a decision. You had to figure out what you were going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And from a very personal level. And when we were already in Vietnam, I mean, obviously there wasn't anything you could do about it.
Right.
All of us, for the most part, it's interesting. When you're in combat, you're probably one of the biggest proponents of anti-war that there could ever be.
Okay.
I mean, when you're getting shot at, you,
right.
you don't want war to be taking place.
Mm-hmm.
But at that level, when you're there, you don't have a choice. I mean,
yes, sir.
What are you going to do?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what are you going to do?
Right.
You get down as low to the ground as you can possibly get, and when it opens up, you're going to turn around and open up right back.
Yes, sir.
You're there to survive, and that's really all that it entails.
Mm-hmm.
We knew what was going on in the United States. I don't think it had a major demoralizing factor at all. I mean, we were there. It was too late. I mean, what are you going to do?
Right, right. Yes, sir. All right. Well, at the point where where you were injured and you were evacuated, did you have any feelings on how the war, any feelings or any thoughts on how the war was going at that point? Did you have any notion that the war would eventually be lost?
It was at such a stalemate at that point in time that I don't. We were fighting a battle daily.
Okay.
We weren't fighting a war. We were fighting a day-to-day survival. We were pretty much in survival mode. Once I got injured and started going back to the hospital system, like I'd mentioned before, I got to see some of the damage that was taking place.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really odd thing to try to explain. Your feelings are, we don't want to be there because we're losing people.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you're thinking back, I've got buddies there that I went through hell with,
mm-hmm.
and they're still there right now. Mm-hmm. They're still there fighting that war. So what do we do? Where are we? How are we going to do this in order to get ourselves into? I didn't trust anything that was going on in the peace processes.
Okay.
I just didn't see the North Vietnamese doing that. I could see the United States saying, we're going to go through and we're going to sign these treaties and we're going to make this stop.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I couldn't see the North Vietnamese doing that.
Right.
They were, I mean, now I go back and I look at it and I see the situations as it is today, and I see the country of Vietnam as it is today, and even though I don't agree with their political system, I see the people at peace.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
I see them living their life, and their life seems to be, to me personally, significantly better than it was when I was there.
Mm-hmm.
Because those people were really struggling. Both the North and South were really struggling at that point. I mean, people were getting killed on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
They were just trying to survive. And now, today, that isn't going on. They're not getting shot. They're
right.
not getting shot at. They're not being susceptible to the torture processes that were taking place then.
Mm-hmm.
And I figure for them, it's a much better life. So I guess now, today, I go back and I say, what the heck were we doing?
Okay.
Why were we even bothering to do that? At the time, we didn't know what the end result was going to be. At the time, we didn't know what Vietnam was going to turn out and wind up being. The assumption was, you know, the communists are going to come in, take it over, then they're going to step off into another country and do the same thing in another country and do the next same thing. And we could see that progression potentially taking place, and that's what we were there to try to prevent.
Mm-hmm.
But it got way out of control. The problem was we sent in a lot of people to not do anything.
Okay. All right. moving on to after you were wounded and your stint in the various hospitals that you had to go through, could you talk a little bit? I know you talked a little bit about these different places that you went to, but could you talk about, I guess, how would you rate the treating you received, the treatment you received, rather, at the various hospitals and places that you were taken care of at?
I have to say it was probably the best of my life.
Okay.
The people that were there, the nurses and the doctors and the, you know, all the way through that, I mean, that's all they saw day in and day out was mm-hmm. the type of injuries and wounds that come out of a combat situation. That's what they were trained to do, and that's what they did. And I know it had to have some impact on a lot of them because of the devastation of some of these injuries. Everything I ever saw through that whole process was as good as you could get for the given situation. Obviously, when you're out at in a combat area and you're working out of a Quonset hut and you've got intermittent electricity based off how good your generators are working that day,
mm-hmm.
the quality may not be as good as you would expect here in the United States from a big medical center here today.
Okay.
But given that, the supplies were well, always there. Never heard of them running out of supplies. They maybe had to fight for them on their end. I wouldn't know that, but I know when I was there, I never saw a shortage of supply at all from anything that we did.
Okay.
The care of the individuals, the people that were there, cared about what they were doing. They cared about the troops. They cared about, and us being trained in the military, we were used to not necessarily working under the best conditions. And so when we got into a hospital, I mean, that's like heaven. I remember when they took me out of Benoit and flew me up to Saigon, or took me up to Saigon to fly out of Vietnam.
Okay.
I mean, I got to stay in an Air Force hospital, and it's like, wow. I mean, that was like heaven compared to anything I'd seen there.
Uh-huh.
And it kind of made you go, gee, why didn't I join the Air Force? But everything, the quality of it was exceptional.
Uh-huh.
Once I got here in the United States, again, you know, I'm in a military hospital that was built for World War II, so it's old.
Mm-hmm.
Old facility, creaky floors, that kind of thing. But the care and the treatment that we got was excellent.
Okay.
There were some concerns that I had because of the type of injury I had, that it might be a longer-term injury. I'm left-handed, and it was on my left wrist.
Okay.
And I was very concerned that I might lose or have limited use of my left hand, which, I mean, my right arm is just there to balance out my body. It really doesn't have a whole lot of function. Well, I'm left-handed, very left-handed.
Yeah.
And so I had a lot of concern about that. And going through the physical therapy, which was a daily thing, I mean, they worked me through that, and I worked hard at that. But they worked me through that to the point to where I was back to about as good as you're ever going to get.
Mm.
And it's interesting because I came back, and just before I got out of the Army, they ran me through my final physical. Your final physical was very similar to your original physical before you went in.
Yeah.
It was a kind of bend over and smile kind of thing.
Right.
And, you know, yeah, you got a pulse, so you're alive, you're good.
Uh-huh.
And it was just pretty much the same thing getting out. One of the things they did was a hearing test.
Okay.
And at that point, they said it looks like you've had a gradual hearing loss. Would you like to stay and we'll put you through some more testing? Well, that wasn't an option. I was not going to stay in the Army. So, no, that's okay. I'm fine. Let me out. So I got out of the military, and that was in 1971.
Okay.
And in about 1991, my hearing was getting bad, and it was getting worse and worse. And I had tinnitus, which is a ringing in the ears, and I'd had that as long as I could remember, the whole time I was after I got out of the Army.
Okay.
And so I went out. My brother, who was also in the Army, had a hearing loss. His was definitely Army-related. They fired a weapon off next to his ear, and he lost his hearing in one ear. He told me, he said, call the VA. Get a hold of the VA and tell them you've got a hearing loss. They'll help you. And I said, well, it's been so long. I'm sure it's just hereditary. I'm not going to worry about it. And he said, no, you really need to call them. You need to get them involved. And I put it off. I just didn't feel I wanted to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that up until about 2 years ago.
Okay.
And I kept hearing from different people about the VA and different things that the VA was doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, I'll go down and talk to some people. So I went down to the VA, talked to them, and they said, absolutely, we need to turn you in for your hearing right now.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime, if you've been in combat, and you've been in combat, and you have a hearing loss, and you have tinnitus, that's probably directly attributable to being in combat.
Mm-hmm.
We need to get you enrolled in the system, and we need to go from there. So they did, and the VA did a hearing test. Now, keep in mind, I had bought hearing aids before that on my own.
Okay.
I had never gone through an audiology test any better than what the VA gave me.
Mm.
It was absolutely excellent. Intimidated the first time I went, because I went to the major VA hospital here in Loma Linda. And when I walked in, one of the things they wanted to do was give me a blood test.
Mm.
Okay, well, we'll do that. So they gave me where the area was, and I went upstairs to the area. And when we walked in the room, it looked like there had to be 200 people sitting in that room waiting for blood tests. And I went, oh, here we go. Long line, going to wait forever.
Right.
So I went up to the front, and they gave me a number. They said, here's your number. They'll call your number when they do, go to the station they tell you to go to. So I go sit down, and I had like number 137 or something, and they're calling number 3. And I'm going, I'm going to be here all day.
Right.
And all of a sudden I realized they weren't calling the numbers in sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
I was in to have my blood test within 5 minutes.
Oh, wow.
And I noticed that that's what they were doing. People were moving in and out of that room the whole time. I mean, you just weren't there that long.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of care that I've always gotten out of the VA in the last 2 years. So, I'm extremely happy with the care that the VA is giving now. You hear some of the horror stories and stuff, but I personally have not run into that. I've had excellent care out of the VA. And it kind of goes back to my time in Vietnam. It just has to do with the military is going to do the best they can under the conditions that they're in at the time that they're doing whatever service they're providing.
Right.
And that's kind of what I came up against.
Okay. All right. Well, that certainly answers my next question, which would be how do you rate the VA? But okay, that takes care of that question. How about your homecoming? What type of homecoming did you have?
When I got home, I had already sold my car, so I didn't have any vehicle at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Had a pretty good idea of what I wanted to do, because I now had all this fantastic $50 a month combat pay that I'd gotten. Plus, there was no place to spend money there when I was there, so all of my military pay sat in the bank. It didn't go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I think I spent $10 a month or something to buy cans of Coke, and that was about it.
Okay.
So all of my income for that time, be it as small as it was getting stashed away. So I knew I had some money.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't exactly sure how much, but I knew I had some. So I figured when I come home, I'll buy a car. I flew home to Travis. Then from Travis, I came down to Fort Ord, which is, again, Monterey Bay Peninsula area.
Okay.
And my brother and his wife lived about 30 miles away from Fort Ord. So they were the first people I got to see. They came down like a day or two after I got there and visited. And then the first weekend after I got back, I had an opportunity to go home.
Okay.
So I flew from Monterey down to Los Angeles, and my mother and a friend of mine came down to pick me up at the airport. And so that was my first initial thing. From there, they drove me home, and at home I got the opportunity to just go and see people. And it was nice, and it wasn't a big thing. I mean, it wasn't a big hoopla party or anything like that. It was more of my getting an opportunity to go out and see people and get a chance to talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the interesting things was when I got hurt, there's back in the day of no cell phones or anything like that, I was in the hospital in Benoit for a day, and I started to write a letter. Keep in mind, I'm left-handed.
Okay.
I started to write a letter, to my mother. And, in fact, I still have it because I never mailed it because I couldn't get it done. And it wasn't very legible, but I still have that letter.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, I flew up to Saigon. From Saigon, they flew me over to Japan. And so the first chance I got to make a phone call was in Japan.
Okay.
So it had been almost a week since I got hurt. So it was, early morning in Japan time. That I called my mother, and not realizing the time difference, I caught her at night and got her out of bed and told her, I was trying to think how I'm going to word this to give the minimal amount of shock and make it not sound that bad. Because really, to me personally, I didn't think it was that bad. But so I called her and told her I got hurt, and it's my left wrist is hurt, and I'm in Japan. And I'm coming home. And during her sleepiness and my exuberance in explaining what had happened, because it was kind of hard to explain, but she somehow, the word started getting around at home, and I heard everything from my arm had gotten blown off by a landmine,
oh, goodness.
My arm had been shot off, to I got caught in a booby trap, to... everybody had these different opinions, so the rumor mill, I guess, was pretty rampant. But I did have, at that time, a cast from my fingertips up to about my elbow.
Okay.
And it was nothing more than trying to keep my hand rigid for a period of time.
Yes, sir.
So that spooked a few people out.
Mm-hmm.
But I kept telling everybody, it's really not that bad. I mean, it's, like a 3-inch long gash across my wrist. The problem was I cut all my tendons. But I said, when you see it, it's really not that bad. I just can't move my fingers. So everybody kind of calmed down after that. But I guess it was pretty traumatic there for about a week or two before I actually got physically home, because everybody didn't know what had happened. But everybody seemed to be pretty happy that I was back. And I had comments have happened since a number of times that people have said, you changed. You really, really changed from the time you left till the time you got home.
Mm-hmm.
It was a big, dramatic change. And I kept, what? I don't feel like I've changed. No, there's a dramatic change.
Mm-hmm.
You grew up. You went from being that rowdy teenager kid to being a man.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that had to do with combat experience and just the military experience in general, but that was the comments that I got back since, and this has been within the last 10 to 15 years. People have all said the same thing. You really changed during that time frame. And became much more independent, even though I was always been really independent. Became much more independent after I got back.
All right. Were you able to keep up with any of the guys that were in the unit that were still in Vietnam after your injury?
Look here real quick. Yeah, we get a half an hour. I'll try to keep this as brief as I can, but this was the part that I was really kind of looking forward to.
Okay.
Back around 2000, I was sitting at home with a wife one day, and kind of bring you current a little bit. I've got two older daughters now.
Okay.
They're both married and have kids, and so I've got grandkids. And so my life has gone on very well. Vietnam was always something that I had, you know, I'd talked about it. People knew I'd been there. Never got into a lot of long conversations about it. And about 2000, a movie had come out called We Were Soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a movie that starred Mel Gibson. And it was a story about the 1st of the 7th Cav and their big fight that they got into back in November of 68, I think, or 65, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
it was one of the first major battles in Vietnam. And it, we saw the movie, watched the movie, and I'm one of these people that pick things apart.
Okay.
Especially movies about Vietnam. And we're sitting there, and the movie came on. I said, oh, geez, it's about First Cav. That's kind of cool, because that's who I was with.
Mm-hmm.
And they're showing some of the beginning scenes of it, and we're watching it. And he's about to get, Mel Gibson's about to get on a helicopter. And I'm sitting there, and I go, let's see if he puts his hand, let's see, number one, if he rides the skids. Hanging your feet out the door.
Uh-huh.
And number two, let's see if he grabs the hole that's in the airframe right behind the door of the pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, he did.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going, that's pretty realistic. And then it got into some of the battle scenes, and that was, it was much more long, extended periods of time that they were in combat. Most of our firefights, like I'd mentioned before, were short.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, 10 minutes at the most. Maybe 15 minutes. But a lot of realism in the movie, a lot of things were done right.
Okay.
They were done the way I remembered it. And so at the end of the movie, I told my wife, I said, that was really a good movie. I said, I need to go back and look and figure out, because I couldn't at that point remember which unit I was with. I need to go back and figure out which unit I was with, because that was kind of neat.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went and I dug all my old papers out. Now, back in 1986, I'd gotten a letter from a friend of mine that was in Vietnam with, that he was trying to put a reunion together to go to Washington, D.C., and I'd actually gotten a phone call from a guy that I was really close to when I was in Vietnam. We'd lost contact after that.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I got a phone call from him. He had found me through my mother, who still lived at the same house I was born and raised in.
Okay.
And he knew I was from Riverside, so that's how he contacted her. And anyway, he called and said that they were going to do this reunion, wanted me to try to go. And at that time, financially, I just couldn't afford to go from California to Washington
mm-hmm.
State, spend time there. I just couldn't financially do it. So I had to pass on that. Well, that, in the meantime, I had those, that letter, so I had a little bit of information there. I had quite a few of my records that I had from Vietnam. Pulled all that information out. Found out I was with D Company, 1st of the 8th Cav,
mm-hmm.
and thought, well, you know, now I've got this information, what am I going to do with it? So I tried to call one of the phone numbers that was on there, the letters. And obviously it had been disconnected because it had been quite a few years.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, go look on the internet. So I started Googling Delta Company 1st of the 8th, 1st Cav. Couldn't find a whole lot of information about that particular unit, but I did find out about the battalion a little bit, started doing some more research there. But I just wasn't having a whole lot of luck. And then as I found battalion on the battalion website, they mentioned the Texas Tech Vietnam Archive Project.
Okay.
And, hey, that's cool. And they said, you need to go, and this is what you need to do, and find out this information. So that's kind of neat. So I started poking around, and within the archives of the Texas Tech Project are the daily officers' logs for every day of every year that the 1st of the 8th Cav was in Vietnam.
Huh. Oh, wow.
So there's a daily record, written out daily record of every day for every company for 1st of the 8th Cav, all in PDF files. And I thought, that's interesting. Let's go see if those are what I think they are. So I went and I found a record for the day that I got hurt. And what the daily officers' logs are is it's the record that's written by the radio telephone operators in battalion headquarters from the radio records that I used to call in daily.
Huh. Okay, wow.
And all that information was recorded for the entire time I was there.
Huh.
It basically gives you a record of everything that transpired during that time frame. And it was amazing. It was like somebody had taken and rewritten my entire life for 6 months. And all of that information was out on those records. So what I did was I thought, this is too good of information to pass up on. So I put together my own little website and basically went back, reread all of those files, and figured out day by day what I had been doing. And talk about memories coming back and just flooding memories, things that I, big details that I'd completely forgotten about.
Wow.
That were brought back because of that. And I thought, now I got to share it. So I put this website together, and again, I had not been able at that point to contact anybody from my company at all. When I got hurt, all of anything that I had, photos, letters, anything like that, were in a ammo can that was strapped on my back. And when I got hurt, the first thing they did was take that off me. So I didn't have that. I lost all my pictures. I lost everything. And I never got it back. It wasn't something I could recover. So I didn't have any pictures, didn't have anything to share from that standpoint, but I was able to at least put out this information that I found at Texas Tech.
Yes, sir.
And sure enough, I started getting some hits on it. And since then, I now have about 60 to 70 names of people that I was with out of 110 spanned over 6 months. And these are people that I've been able to get email addresses from. They've all gone out. I now have photos. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of photos were taken during that time. I'm in some of them. One of the guys that I made contact with sent me a picture, sent me a bunch of pictures through, through an email. And as I'm going through the pictures, I spotted one of them, and I vividly remember the day he took the picture. And I didn't know him that close. I didn't know his name. All I remember is hearing somebody and turning around and seeing somebody snapping a picture. And that's the picture he took that day. So I've got that one out there, again, with hundreds and hundreds of other, lots of them that I remember very vividly what was going on during that time frame. But the website has just gone nuts. I mean, I've got all of these stories and images and photos and things that have transpired, and that all started 10 years ago. 2000 was when I started. So, but it all triggered off of the Texas Tech archives, the things you guys are doing. And it's people that don't know about it should. Anybody that's been to Vietnam should know that that data is out there. That kind of information is available. It's just, it's absolutely amazing. And it's opened me up. Like I say, I'm going to the VA now, very happy with what they're doing. It made a lot of connections back with the people that I knew, the people I associated with during the time I was there. I mean, it's even so much as I had one of the guys that contacted me was the artillery forward observer for the company. I was his RTO. And he sent me an email and said, this is who I am, blah, blah, blah. And I sent it back. I said, this is amazing. This is who I am. And then suddenly it clicked. And I was his RTO.
Right.
He had an audio tape of somebody had a tape player that was in the battalion headquarters. and they had turned it on when a firefight took place that I was involved in.
Hmm.
Now, I wasn't on the radio communications that were going on, but the guy that took my place was.
Huh, okay.
And give you an example of how this website does things. The other day, about 2 weeks ago, I get an email out of the blue saying, I wanted to write this email to you and tell you thank you so very much. I found the audio tapes of the firefight that took place, and the guy on the radio that's talking in was my dad.
Oh, wow.
And he died about 10 years ago.
Hmm.
So that's the kind of things that go on with this.
Yes, sir.
And again, it goes back to what Texas Tech put out on the website. And it's those kinds of things that all tie back and connect all of these little things back together again. I can tell you for a fact that there are people that I have email addresses for that know the websites there that don't do a lot of communicating. They're the types of individuals, or they are the individuals, that put it away. They're done with it. They don't want to think about it. They don't want to deal with it. And maybe it's not even a wrong term. Maybe it's not the fact they don't want to deal with it. They just don't want it. They lived that part of their life, and they don't want to relive it.
Yes, sir.
Then there's the other side of the fence, which are people that lived that and went through it and then tried to bury it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And tried to get away from it. And I can tell you for a fact, a lot of times drugs come into play.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you a lot of times drinking comes into play, that they're hiding it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just making it go away. Because it's a very painful memory for a lot of people. And I know of specific people that's very true. That's exactly what they've done. And then there's other people that are very open about it. And that, hey, it's part of my life. It's what I did. It's part of my life. And that's kind of the road that I've taken. I mean, there were a lot of years I didn't talk a lot about it. A lot of people that I was friends with maybe didn't even know I'd been to Vietnam. But I got beyond that, and I got to the point where I found it much easier to tell people and let them be what it is. Things have changed. When I first came home, you really didn't want people to know you'd been there, because it was an awful lot of people who, at that point, were very adamant against it and
right.
would potentially take it out on you because you'd been there. I never personally ran into a lot of that, but I know people that did. And so you didn't talk about it much. Now things have changed.
Right.
I have a sticker on the back window of my pickup truck, the Vietnam emblem, so people know that's where I was. I've got the 1st of the 8th Cav emblem on it. I've had a number of people come up to me and say thank you, and that means an awful lot. An awful lot, because we didn't get that when we first came home.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
We didn't get that at all. I didn't, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
People didn't. I got that uniform off as soon as I could, because I didn't want people to know. I didn't want to have to confront anybody with that. Was I proud of what I did? Yeah. In my own mind, yes, I was.
Mm-hmm.
I did it. No matter how I look at it, I did it. Something I did is part of my life.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. Well, I certainly appreciate you telling me that story about how the archive, the website was able to help out in all of this, because it's good to know that that the work that we're doing, you know, means something, that it is helping. So certainly appreciate you telling me about that. A few more questions, if you don't mind, before wrapping up. Did you follow the war closely after you returned home? And if so, what was your reaction to the way it concluded in the fall of Saigon?
I didn't pay a lot of attention to it, because when I got home and I came back to the hospital system, I was still in the military. I still had roughly 9 months left to go.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Fort Hood, Texas, was there, and in March, the first calf came home. So since that was the unit I was with in Vietnam, essentially, the way I looked at it is the war had ended for us. You know, that's kind of the way I looked at it. Even though the truth was it hadn't, I knew there was such dramatic withdrawals taking place at that time of people coming home that we were kind of winding down. I knew there was still a lot of activity, but there wasn't a lot of major conflicts after that. The South Vietnamese Army was taking the brunt of it, and that's what they were doing was the Vietnamese the Vietnamization program,
right,
and trying to turn it over to them. I didn't have a lot of confidence that that was going to work, but that's what the decision was to do. The person that I thought of the most during that time was our Kit Carson scout that was a lot of fondness with, a guy named Dan, and I've mentioned him before earlier.
Yes, sir.
I thought about him a lot and wondered, you know, what's happened. You know, did he make it? Is he still there? Or is he still, you know, obviously the first calves come home. He didn't come home, I'm sure.
Right.
I mean, he was home as far as that goes. So there was some concern about him, and I thought about him on occasion. I didn't follow it a lot. When I heard that South Vietnam fell, very mixed emotions, a lot of thoughts about why in the hell were we there? What did we do? I mean, why did we let it get to the point that, you know, essentially we quote-unquote lost the war? I don't ever look at it as a fact that we lost it. We just didn't win it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We backed out of it. We just didn't win it. We didn't go in. I think initially we went into, but things so dramatically changed that the decision was made, well, we don't really want to win this thing. We just want to get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way I've always looked at it. But at the same time, it's like, why did we do what we did and put so many lives in jeopardy and change dramatically so many people's lives, in a lot of cases lose an awful lot of lives, to do what we did?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think initially the people that started this thing thought that's what was going to happen. But as time progressed, that's exactly how it went down. And I still don't understand exactly why we did that. Even today, there's a lot of things going on in the world that I wonder, you know, what the heck are we thinking? You know, why are we doing it the way we're doing it? And I'm not a big warmonger. I think the last thing you do is go to war. The absolute last thing you do. But once you do it to win. You don't go in with the concept of, well, we'll just go in there and fix some things and back out. It's not how you do it. If you're going to get involved in it, you need to go in to win it. But I think over the span of time, a lot of people have maybe looked at the end of the Vietnam War as being, well, the United States lost that war. And I still, to this day, don't think that's true. We just quit.
All right. Okay. You actually, in that response, answered a few of the questions that I had coming up, which was, if you'd like, you can certainly say more about them if you'd like to. The first question I was planning on asking you to wrap things up to get at some of these broader issues was how you felt about American involvement in Vietnam and how you felt also about your own service in Vietnam.
Well, my involvement in Vietnam was a kind of a surprise. I really didn't think I was going to go, but I did. Once I was there, it was survival mode kicked in, and it's, you know, hey, you do what you got to do to survive it. It's an experience that I would not trade for anything. I think a lot of good came out of it for me personally. I grew up a lot. I learned a lot of things. Learned how to do a lot of things that I probably never, ever would have in any way, shape, or form. Learned how to become a lot more independent than I'd ever been before. My service in the Army, the same thing. I learned an awful lot out of that. I would never want to ever have to do it again. But at the same time, I look back on it, and there's a lot of things that I gained from doing that. I still think back to the few people that deserted when I started out when we were in the reception center, and I've always kind of wondered what their lives are like. You know, what, you know, how did they come out? You know, how well are they doing today?
Mm-hmm.
And versus how I'm doing today. And I mean, I'm not by any stretch of the imagination a wealthy man. I live a comfortable life. Been married for 40 years, so I got grown kids that are doing great. I mean, it's, you know, from that aspect, I look at it as I guess I gained a lot out of that,
because mm-hmm.
That was just part of my life up to that point. It was something I gained knowledge from and learned from. At the same time, I look back and I see other people that I'm aware of that it probably had a negative impact because they let it. I think a lot of cases the stress, they let the stress go a different direction with them than what I did. And yeah, I had some problems with it. I mean, I think anybody that goes through that kind of scenario does. But it's a matter of how you handle it. And a lot of people handled it incorrectly and let it take over their lives in a very negative aspect. And I personally don't think that happened to me. I mean, I had some negative impact from it, but I mean, I got past it. But I think there's a lot of people that never got that far with it. And you know, you hear the stories about the homeless vet that's served 3 tours of duty in Vietnam, and he's living out on the streets now. And,
right.
And you think, you know, how could it do that? You know, how could that span of time, even as terrible as it was, dramatically tear up your life? And I guess it just affects people differently. I've lived a happy life. I don't regret anything. I think the sad part of it is there's a lot of people that I knew that never got to do that. You know, their lives were cut short. You know, I guess that's the very saddest part of the whole situation. It's very unfortunate. I know relatives of these people that are living today, and that instant in time had a dramatic impact on their lives. I know. Again, I'll go back, thanks to you guys, the website that I put out. I've had contact from a few people. One of the surprising ones that I got was we had a guy that we were on a fire base got killed, a guy named Vinny Scaretti. And he was killed by an incoming mortar round. And I knew he had really tight family ties, very close-knit family. And one day I got an email, and the email said, "Hi, my name's Vinny Scaretti," and it's got to be a joke. It's got to be a joke. Terrible, terrible joke. And as I read through it, it was Vinny, the guy that I knew in Vietnam's nephew, and Vinny's brother is his dad, and named him after Vinny. And as it turned out, Vinny, the nephew, was in 1st Cav and was getting ready to deploy to Iraq.
Oh, wow.
And you talk about spooky. I mean, that, those are the kinds of things that just, they run a chill up and down your spine. I mean, and it happens pretty often that I get a hit on the website and I get something like that happening. And it shows you how interrelated and intertwined people's lives are. And it's sad that those people didn't get the opportunity to live the life that a lot of the others of us have. And I look back now and I think, you know, maybe that's why I do what I do, and maybe that's why I'm the way I am, is I'm hopefully trying to live a little bit of a life for them too.
Yes, sir. All right. Speaking along these lines, have you visited the Vietnam Wall or seen one of the traveling walls? And if so, what was your opinion of it?
I haven't had the opportunity.
Okay.
It's one of the things I would like to do at some point.
Mm-hmm.
I did have a chance back about 3 years ago to visit the traveling wall.
Okay.
That was out here in Oceanside. And the traveling wall that I got to see was, it's a miniature replica.
Mm-hmm.
It's, can't remember physical dimensions, but it's, it was big.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, probably 100 yards long. And it was, they had placed it right on the beach in Oceanside, which is a very much a Marine Corps base. But so we had the opportunity to drive down there and see that. And I was a little bit apprehensive at that point.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know. I had no idea how I was going to react. I had no idea at all. I had already at that point, I'd already had the website put together, so I had the names of the guys that I was with that lost their lives during the time I was there. And I had printed a list of those names because I wanted to find them. So when I got there, we went and had the opportunity to start from one end, figure out where the panel was, the names were that I was interested in, and then got to see, because of the way the wall was set up, and it goes in a chronological order, you get an idea of the span of time. And when you actually take and physically look at a given name on that panel, and then you stand back and you look at the entire panel and see where the name is that you specifically want to see, it's overwhelming. And I had taken some paper and a crayon and was tracing names and was looking at names that I had on my list and finding them and tracing them. And I stopped for a minute and I just kind of walked back about maybe 5-10 steps and stood there for a second. I was about halfway through the tracing. And my wife stops and she turns around and she looks at me and she says, "Are you okay?" And I said, "This is hard. This is really hard." And I think that was probably one of the biggest impacts that I've had, was just the trauma of seeing the physical dimension of an individual and the size of an individual's name versus all the names. And it kind of fills in the whole picture when you see something like that. Someday, yeah, I want to go see the one in Washington. One of my big dream vacations, if I could ever afford to do it, was I would love to go to the East Coast and see all of the historical areas. We had an opportunity a few years back to go to Hawaii, and when we were talking about going,
mm-hmm.
my wife and I were discussing it. All the different people that I talked to that had been to Hawaii a bunch of different times all said the same thing. Oh, well, you need to go here, you need to go there, this island's so beautiful, or you need to go to the big island and see this and see that. And my wife and I are sitting there, and we've got the tour books out, and we're looking at it. She's looking at the different things, and I'm looking at the different things. And I said, "You know what? We got to just go to Honolulu. We just got to go see Pearl Harbor. We've got to go see the memorial at Pearl Harbor. We've just got to go see the tourist trap stuff."
Uh-huh.
Because that's what I want to do.
Right.
I've never seen it. I've seen pictures, but I've never physically seen it. And that's what I want to do. So that's what we did. I had a great vacation, and that's what I want to do if I ever get the opportunity to go there to Washington, D.C. I want to go see what I want to go see. I want to go see, obviously, the Vietnam Memorial. I'd like to go see the Tomb of the Unknowns. I'd like to go see the World War II Memorial now that that's up and running. Those are the kinds of things that I enjoy, and it's just, you know, I'm not, I guess I'm a bit of a historical buff now, and those kind of things I enjoy, but I again would hopefully someday I'll get the opportunity to go. My sister keeps threatening if she ever wins the lotto, that's the person you should be there.
Right.
Anyway, hopefully someday I'll get a chance to do it, but I didn't get to see the traveling one, and that was very worthwhile. Highly recommend anybody to go see that. That was very worthwhile.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. right. Well, I hope you do get the chance to make that trip. Before wrapping up, is there anything else we should say? Anything else you'd like to say? Anything else we should cover?
Well, the only thing I'll throw out, and this is just for what it's worth, again, I think the project that you guys are doing and things that you're trying to accomplish with this are going to be of dramatic benefit down the road. I think one of the things that's very important that people have a tendency to forget is history. And the fact that if you go back now and you start reading and trying to find out information and you know, things about old wars, you know, World War One and Civil War, especially even the Civil War, I mean, that's a very good example. The one thing you'll find is that there isn't a tremendous amount of accurate, individual, true historical data.
Right.
There's some letters, and I think that's where we find a whole different perspective to history than what you find in textbooks that were written by people that are just gathering the historical record portion of it. They're not getting involved with the individuals and how the individuals looked at, because everybody has a different perspective.
Right.
I've many times told different people, you know, you talk to me, if you ask me something about Vietnam, you may get an entirely different story than what you would from another person, because Vietnam, believe it or not, is a big country.
Right.
It's, you know, it's about the same size as the state of California, so it's a pretty good sized country. There's mountains, very, very steep mountains. I can tell you that for a fact because I went up and down a lot of them. There's big sandy areas and beaches. There's flat plains. There's deltas and rivers and swamps. It's a pretty diversified area to be in. And the different units operated differently. First Cab had very specific rules about things that we did. We weren't allowed to wear boonie hats in the field. We had to wear a steel pot. We had to wear a helmet. A lot of pictures you see from Vietnam, you see guys walking around with boonie hats when they were out on patrol. We couldn't do that. We weren't allowed to. So, you know, it's different people had different ways of looking at it and different ways of seeing things. Even guys that were in First Cab, the First Cab moved around in that country a few times. So you talk to people that were there in 67, 68, it was an entirely different war than it was when I was there. And it's just a combination of the territory and the way that the units operated at that particular time. So if you look at that and then you look at a project like what you guys are doing and you listen to some of the oral histories from different people, you're going to get all these different concepts and ideas and viewpoints, and it's just an amazing way to do it. And I think history will tell us that what you guys are doing now is going to pay back 1,000-fold in the years to come. And the information eventually, the true people, the people who lived it, the people who were there, the people that went through all of this, aren't going to be around. And we're going to get into the same scenario as we do with the Civil War. Those people aren't around anymore. The only thing we have to go by is the history of the data that was collected, the time it took place. And those people aren't around, so you can't go and ask the questions anymore.
Right.
So, again, I want to thank you guys for what you're doing. I think it's a great thing.
Yes, sir. Well, thank you for taking the time to participate and be a part of the oral history program. let me go ahead and stop the interview now.